All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and light me up and throw away the key. Or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away. But I feel alright. I feel alright tonight. Feel alright. I feel alright tonight. And I bring you precious contraband and ancient tales from distant lands.
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? It's Nick DiGilio. That's me. We are live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, and Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. Our phone number is 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for talk or text. You can follow us on Twitter, at Nick D Show. Best way to stay connected is on our Facebook page. Like us right now. It's facebook.com/Nick D Show. And subscribe to our podcast. It's free. Every single second of every single show is podcast and available. You can go to iTunes or any place where you get your podcasts. Subscribe. It's free, and it'll automatically be sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. It is Thursday, which means it's Triple Play Thursday. You hear me, Triple Play Thursday? So get your requests in. One artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. Coming up in just a few minutes, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. And you can check out Pyle Books, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. For more information, he's written a bunch of books. He is a space expert, and we love to have him on to talk all things space. We have a lot of space topics and space in the news stories to get to and much more. It's always a lot of fun when we talk to Rod. Rod will be in just a few minutes. We are also going to talk about Pedro Bell passed away. He was an artist. He designed the covers for most of the Funkadelic albums. And he passed away. And those album covers were always really cool. So that's going to get us to talking about the best album covers of all time. This is a topic we haven't talked about in a very, very long time. But it's the best album covers of all time. We might even jump into the worst album covers of all time because there's a website. I can't remember what it is, but there's a website dedicated to the worst album covers of all time. And some of them are absolutely hilarious. So we may chip into that too. We are going to get to the weirdest, strangest world records. And much more. So that's all coming up on the show. We would love to hear from you. Talk or text at 312-981-7200. There it is. Let's talk with my producer. That's Tom Hush. Tom, how are you?
There we go. Hey, I'm great.
Okay, good. Good.
Just hanging out in the producer village.
Yeah, in your little hut. I was talking to you off the air. You're behind on Big Brother.
Yeah, but you revealed something to me that has me excited to catch up.
Yeah. Zingbot was on.
Good old Zingbot.
Yeah, Zingbot. I always look forward to the Zingbot episode of Big Brother. It cracks me up. And he was in fine form last night. Good old Zingbot. But yeah, no, it's coasting along. Show's coasting along. I got a feeling I know who's going to go home tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure about it. And there are now a couple of people that I actually like on the show. It was hard to get to like anybody because there were so many idiots.
The house full of blank offs.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, Zingbot got him though. Got him good.
Naturally.
Yeah. So, let's go to the newsroom, and that's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Hey, good morning, sir.
Have you ever watched a moment of Big Brother?
Not a single second.
Yeah, I didn't think so.
I didn't really. I had to look into it and see what you guys were talking about.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous reality show where a whole bunch of people live in a house with a bunch of cameras watching them 24/7.
I could see the appeal, actually. We won't get into that.
Yeah,
but
I watch it every year, every summer. The summer's not complete unless I watch Big Brother. And then I bond with my mom on about it because she loves it. So she and I watch Big Brother and then talk about it pretty regularly.
Yeah.
But Tom's the first person associated with the show who ever watched it. Everybody else is just like, shut up, you know?
When is it on? I'm going to have to check this
Sunday,
out.
It's on Sunday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
So I'm going to watch it this Sunday because I'm off Monday, so I might as well stay up and watch it. I assume it's on nighttime.
It's on CBS. So. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I'll check it out.
7 o'clock on Sunday, 7 o'clock on Wednesday, 8 o'clock on Thursday. They elect a new head of household on Sunday. On Wednesday, they play for the veto competition. And then on Thursday, they evict somebody. That's how it works.
Okay.
Each week. So, yeah, I like the show.
I'll check it out.
Yeah.
I've been behind the scenes trying to get into some of the films that you guys are into. You know, some of the horror films. You've let me borrow some of the DVDs. So
yeah.
I'll check out this one.
Yeah, I don't know if you'll like it. I don't know.
It's just surveillance video footage, I guess, live happening.
They've got cameras in the house.
Yeah.
And it's 24/7.
Like MTV's Real World similar.
Well, yeah, except this is like live 24/7. You can actually watch the live feeds anytime you want.
Okay. You can watch them whisper and just lay around.
There's a lot of shirtless guys and women in bikinis whispering. That's what a lot of Big Brother is.
Is that a requirement of the show that the guys have to be shirtless most of the time?
I don't think Nick has worn a shirt this entire season.
Yeah. No, he's just...
I think he wears a shirt just for eviction. And then that's it. Because he's shirtless the whole time.
That's a formal affair. You have to wear a shirt for eviction.
So... Yeah.
Cliff wears a shirt.
It's not always.
I'm trying to think. Have I seen Cliff Hogg with a shirt on?
If you watched the show, you would not forget it. By the way, he did. Well, I mean, Zingbot got him and he pulled up his shirt to show his belly.
Very nice.
Last night. Zingbot, by the way, Vic, Zingbot is a robot who shows up every year for one episode and just basically roasts the contestants.
What do you mean a robot? Like literally?
It's a guy in a robot suit.
Oh,
and he talks like this. and he just basically insults people. That's what Zingbot does.
Yeah, your description's not really exciting me about this show.
What about casual voyeurism doesn't excite you, Vic?
Yeah.
Well, watching shirtless guys, for one, doesn't sound too fun all the time. The girls in the bikinis, I don't know. Whispering, I don't know. I'll check it out.
Yeah. Well, I don't see you getting hooked. That's all I'm saying.
I don't think,
and we're more than we're like 3/4 of the way through the season.
Yeah.
So you're, you know, I mean,
hard to jump in the middle of something like that. I don't know the characters. You connect with the people. That's what it is that gets you hooked on these shows. And I've been hooked on them before. You know, not this one, but others.
Yeah. That's the only one I watch though. Like for some reason,
what got you into this one?
I don't know. I started watching it like I actually found the premise to be really interesting.
Mm.
And I don't, but I don't watch Survivor. I've tried to watch Survivor. I don't watch Survivor. Amazing Race. I don't watch the Amazing Race, which I hear is really great. And
it's a fun show.
Yeah, my mom likes that one too. She really likes that one. That's kind of the only one I watch. I mean, outside of like as far as reality shows go, I mean, Top Chef is also a reality show, and I'm addicted to that. But I think that's kind of the only sort. Like, I don't watch any of the Bachelors or the Bachelorettes or any of that stuff.
Me neither. No, those reality cooking competitions.
I watch those,
fun.
Those I watch. That's like cooking shows. I've been addicted to for forever.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you really got into the Great British Bake Off.
Yes, I love the Great British Bake Off.
Amazing, especially when they added Noel Fielding.
You want to know what the best reality show of all time was? It was only one season. I've talked about it before. It was on VH1. It was called Bands on the Run. It was the best reality show of all time, where they took four bands. Gave them some money for a little bit of money for each day. They're in a van. They travel across the country. They do gigs, and they sell merch. And whoever like sells the most tickets and sells the most merch wins that city. And the band that won is a band called Flickerstick. And I actually went to see them twice. I saw them twice. My ex-girlfriend and I, Cheeto Fingers.
Yeah,
we were obsessed with Bands on the Run. It was the best reality show of all time. And it was Flickerstick. It was Harlow. These were the bands. The Josh Dotis Band and Soulcracker. Those were the four bands that participated in Bands on the Run. It was the it's still my favorite reality show of all time. It was only on for one season. I can't believe they haven't brought it back. And the fact that Flickrstick won was fantastic because they did nothing. They sold no merch. They sold no tickets. You know, they barely won any of the cities. But the thing is, before you get kicked off, you have to do a battle of the bands. And they would win every battle of the bands. These guys were drunk. They fought. There were two brothers in the band who, you know, who were smacking each other around. They were drunk. Like the whole every episode, they would go to a city and they would drink. They wouldn't sell merch. They wouldn't sell tickets. But they would win every battle of the band. And then they ended up winning Bands on the Run. And I was obsessed with the show. It was on like 20 years ago. It was on like I want to say 2001, 2002, right around that time. It was the best show. It was like the best show ever. That's the reality show that I was most obsessed with besides Top Chef, which is the crown jewel of reality competition shows. But man, Bands on the Run. I'll never forget it. So, all right. Hey, Cubs won, Vic.
Hey, not doing too bad.
They almost blew it,
though. On the road for change, yeah.
They had a 9-run lead, man. They were up 10-1. They lost 10-7, and it was tight in the bottom of the ninth, too. Mets almost tied it up, man. It's like, how do you blow a 9-run lead?
They love making it excited, making
God.
It exciting.
Anyway, well, they won. That's the only thing that matters is they won. They got a chance to sweep the Mets, which is always good.
I did not picture us being in a position to go for the sweep when we were headed into this road.
No, they were on a bad run. They're only two games out now.
Yeah.
I mean, St. Louis keeps winning, though. That's the problem.
They lost
last night, but St. Louis just keeps winning. That's a problem.
And then we have the Brewers next,
big
right?
Weekend,
Cubs have
yeah.
the Brewers next.
Big weekend.
We'll have
series.
To watch what the Cardinals do against the Reds.
Absolutely.
They split the last time they played 2-2. So it's gonna
be
fun.
Interesting weekend, man. But that's fun because this will be fun. It'll be fun at your house because you got not only that.
Oh man,
you got a Brewers weekend series with the Cubs, and then Thursday the Bears play the Packers.
It's unbelievable.
You're gonna have a fun week, man.
If the Bears and the Cubs win, I probably will ask her to marry me because I know she'll say no.
That's good. Good timing. All right, let's break here because our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us. Always a great time to talk to Rod. We've got a whole bunch of space news to talk about and subjects. He's the best. You can go to pilebooks.com to check out his stuff, and we'll talk with Rod right after we break here on 720 WGN.
1 second, please.
Please, Mr. Kennedy.
Welcome back, everybody. It makes me laugh every time I hear it. Every time I hear it. That's from inside Llewellyn Davis, Coen Brothers, and Adam Driver. JT, man. That's a great movie. That's a really, really great movie. Anyway. Hey, welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here. We're live in the Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m., as we are every weekday morning. Triple Play Thursday, get your requests in. We'll play them later. It's one artist, three songs. Joining us right now for his monthly visit is Rod Pyle. He's an author, a journalist. He's an editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine for the National Space Society, and you can check out pilebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pilebooks.com. We'd love to have Rod on to talk space and more. So let's get Rod in here. Hey, Rod, how are you, man?
Good. How are you doing?
Not bad. Good to hear from you, as usual. Always a pleasure.
It is so nice to be here. After the end of the Apollo 11 anniversary, I can't tell you.
Yeah, well, okay, let's start with that, man. Well, first of all, like we always do, tell everybody a little about yourself, how you got into the space business and all that.
Born almost the same time as the space age and grew up with rockets getting bigger and bigger and everything happening for the first time. And was just about the right age to really be completely smitten with the whole first round of Apollo flights and the first landing on the moon and all the way through that. And then decided I wanted to try and be a scientist. And after differential calculus and I made our acquaintance, decided that was probably not going to be a good idea after all. I went into media. And about 2005, I started writing books. And then a few years ago, I had the good fortune to meet you, and my career was made.
Well, I appreciate that. It's always a great time to have you on. So the Apollo 11, anniversary. Man, it was all over the place. And how did you survive? I know that you were unbelievably busy during that whole time period. How did it go for you?
I was. It was hundreds and hundreds of non-billable hours. It was great. You know, I mean, authors spend a lot of time working by themselves, and it's not like most of us get that much public recognition, except infrequently. So it was really fun to have a couple of months of doing 4 or 5 interviews a day and doing a couple of talks a week and going all over the place. But by the end of it, I was kind of on my hands and knees. You know, you've been through this, I'm sure. You're just at the end of this big media spree, and then it just came to an end, like a hatchet dropped on it. You know, done. That's it. It's over.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, went through a couple of days of kind of being in a little bit of a funk, like, oh, gee, nobody loves me anymore. But, we'll have another one for Apollo 13. And then it's going to be kind of interesting, you know, in my circle of friends who are largely space journalists and authors and TV people and so forth, there was a lot of head scratching about, you know, how big a deal is this anniversary really going to be? Because we thought it might be huge, but we also thought, yeah, it might kind of not really hit the marks that we were expecting. But I think it did overall. And I'll be interested to see. I expect Apollo 13 to be kind of a big deal because it was such a fine piece of drama, the way it was portrayed in the film and so forth.
Yeah.
Apollo 17 is going to be kind of maudlin. So unless we've made pretty good progress towards this new Artemis project landing a man and woman on the moon in a couple of years, that one might be kind of on the more maudlin side. But we'll see.
Okay.
You know? But it was a lot of fun.
How do you think the media handled the 50th anniversary?
That's a really good question. Pretty well. I haven't had a chance to see many of the documentaries. I've seen pieces of a lot of them. There was a lot of there are a couple that were exceptional. We talked about the CNN one. That was great. I thought the Nat Geo one was really good. There are a couple that were a little looser in their construction. And when I say looser, I mean, you know, not quite as close to the facts in some cases. But I thought most of them were really good. And the broader, you know, the print media online and so forth did pretty well. It was just interesting for an old hack like myself who lived through it and has read this stuff 1,000 times to watch younger journalists. And in some cases, speaking mainly of like secondary outlets, you know, clearly not having a lot of mentoring or having enough time to really look up the stuff they're writing about. So a lot of it was a little flimsy, like, you know, there are a few articles I read that treated Apollo 11 like the only time we ever landed on the moon. And I thought, really, you guys?
Oh, wow.
A bunch of them, you know?
Yeah. So, I mean, I know it was, there was a lot of saturation. I know that because every time, you know, I would go on the computer or I would flip around on TV, you know, that week leading up and on the actual anniversary day, there was stuff everywhere. So, I mean, it wasn't like people weren't unaware of it. They did celebrate it pretty massively on the media outlets that I was familiar with.
Yeah. I saw the same thing. And I'm glad. You know, I don't know what's going to happen with this new NASA lunar initiative. Nobody does. But I'm glad it's at least starting to get some legs, because had this anniversary come and gone without something ambitious like that coming along for NASA, I think it would have had a little less impact. But because we've kind of got this bookending here of, hey, we went to the moon 50 years ago. It was amazing. Now we're going back to stay and we're going to find water and do amazing things. I think that part was really good. So I think that helped propel it along. Myself.
And the latest book that you wrote about Apollo 11 sold like hotcakes, right?
It did. I think it was either in the 5th or 6th printing when the anniversary came and went. And weirdly, I was looking at Amazon the other day. They actually raised the price after the anniversary. So nobody can figure out what Amazon does. They don't ask the publishers. They just do their own thing. But, it's still chugging along.
Yeah.
So,
and people can get it, too. You can still get it. And there's you can check out all the information at pilebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pilebooks.com. Yeah, it was interesting to see how the younger, you know, as you've mentioned, you know, like the younger people who don't really know about the space program a lot, because, you know, the popularity of the space program is it's more popular now than it has been in a while. But there was a period of time when nobody really followed the space program anymore after the 60s and into the 70s.
Yeah, and then kind of, I think, in the mid-shuttle program before the space station was being put together, it got kind of quiet. And if you talk to people in their 20s and early 30s now, apparently, from everything I've been told and been able to look up, there just wasn't a whole lot of emphasis on this in public education. And, you know, at least in, where I live in Los Angeles, we're so desperate just to get the basics of STEM education going that I can see where they wouldn't spend a lot of time on this kind of thing because it was deemed as possibly unnecessary. But it's a shame because it really was the technological highlight of the 20th century. And it was done here in this country, and that's something I think young people should have access to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was a good time. I'm glad that you've recovered. So
yes,
yeah,
and quite happy to be here.
All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He is a space expert, author, journalist, editor in chief of Ad Astra magazine. We got a lot of space news and topics to talk about. And if you guys want to jump in here with any questions, Rod is here. If you got a space related question or a comment, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for any and all space related questions or concerns. So we'll get that going right after we break here. We got the news coming up right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. Hey, Vic. In your news report there, man, it would be a real shame if they closed down Arlington.
I totally agree.
That's a beautiful place.
It's so fun too. It is a beautiful park and a lot of fun. I've taken my kids there to show them. It, you know, it's one of those activities that a lot of young people these days just have never even experienced, you know, but they're facing a lot of challenges, not just people, not as many people go out there, the purses aren't as big as they used to be, but there's a lot of other things too, animal treatment at parks around, not this park. There's been other parks that have gotten some bad publicity lately because of horses dying, and you know, it's just one of those things that I think is, again, from kind of it's an activity that a lot of people used to take part in, and not so much these days.
My dad and my uncle played the ponies all the time.
Yeah.
And would take me to the track. I've been to many of the tracks, we went to Balmoral, we went to Maywood, Sportsman, and Arlington. And Arlington is just a beautiful, beautiful track.
I didn't do it growing up because I wasn't near one, but when I moved to this area, I started going, and I've been there several times.
Beautiful place.
It really is.
It'd be a shame if they close it down. I just wanted to mention that. I wasn't aware that they were thinking of closing it down that after this season.
You know, hinting at it, it's not been a statement, but some of the things that they've said, and the company that owns that racetrack. Owns Rivers Casino,
mm-hmm.
and there was some thought, you know, that, you know, competing, you know, as far as opening a casino in Arlington now, you know, because they can be open new casinos now, they don't think that they're going to open one in Arlington because it would compete with the one that they already have, the Rivers Casino.
Yeah. Well, I hope it stays around. It's just a beautiful place. And if people haven't gone there, you should. It's a really beautiful place, and it's fun to play the ponies, man.
It is, and we should probably say that the company that owns that racetrack, there is some rumors that they may be opening a casino in Waukegan. Throwing that out there too.
All right, cool. All right, Vic, thanks, man. Let's get back to our conversation now. Rod Pyle is with us. He's an author, journalist, editor in chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. He's our space expert. If you have any space related question or comment, we would love to hear from you via talk or text. Rod is here live, and it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Let's welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks. So if you lose your horse track, I say we set up some zero G Chihuahua racing. What do you think? That might be kind of fun. Some people would think that was mean-spirited, but, you know, there's no impact on their bodies.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have to take all those drugs the horses take. There wouldn't be any losses. They'd just look really fun.
Yeah. All right. We'll figure that out.
Just a thought. Not a helpful thought, but just a thought.
All right.
Yeah.
All right, Rod, let's talk a little bit about some of these space stories, and we'll get to some other things as well that you want to jump into. Our morning man here, Steve Cochran, talked about this on his show and had some fun comments about it. But apparently there was an alleged crime committed in space. There was a space crime.
Let's talk
a little bit about this.
So there's a crew up on the station now, and one of them is a woman named Anne McClain, and she is alleged to have accessed her, separated, I believe, from her wife, and whose name is Summer Worden, and Summer made a complaint to NASA and the Federal Trade Commission that astronaut McClain had accessed Summer's bank account using the computers on the ISS, which, of course, are, you know, federally controlled. And, I mean, this is beyond across space lines, state lines and all that kind of thing, beyond international even. So it gets really kind of thorny and weird. And even though it's not something that would, by on its face, be a felony or anything, it could either be very serious or kind of a shrug, oh, well, you know, somebody went into their estranged spouse's bank account. Now, the astronaut's claim was, look, this is something we had done routinely. We were together. I'm participating in paying for her Summer, the estranged spouse's son's care and education. So there's all these qualifiers. But the bottom line is there's a woman divorcing a woman and an accusation of illegal computer access. And what makes it so weird, of course, is it happening from space.
Yeah.
And although... So, you know, what makes it simpler is that they're both U.S. citizens, and as space law is currently written, and there was an amendment to the original Outer Space Treaty of 1968, NASA did this, or the U.S. government did a special maritime and territorial jurisdiction set of laws that basically says, look, if you're a U.S. citizen in space, you do something naughty, you're covered by U.S. law. So they're both U.S. citizens. But what if this had been a U.S. astronaut stealing or beating up something from a Russian cosmonaut,
right?
Although I suppose the Russian cosmonauts would probably tell you that they're tougher than U.S. astronauts, but whatever the case may be, now you've got this cross-jurisdictional thing. And what's, I think, most interesting about this story, other than the roots of it, is it's kind of waking some people up saying, you know, this could be, space lawyers have been talking about this for a while, they're a pretty rare breed, but this could become a much bigger thing, especially when you start getting tourists and private corporate astronauts up there.
Yeah,
then
yeah.
It gets really thorny.
Yeah. So, yeah, I, you know, it's just, it's a very strange story too. Like I've never heard that before, but it is the question of jurisdiction in space. That you said space laws, when were they written?
Well, there was the original Outer Space Treaty in 1967, which is basically meant to regulate activities voluntarily between the U.S. and the USSR, because we were the only spacefaring powers at that point. But a bunch of aspiring spacefaring countries signed on to it, some that were just flying satellites, none that were flying people other than the two countries I mentioned. But it was meant to look ahead and talk about, you know, no weapons of mass destruction in space, you can't claim territories and things like that. So a lot of it was kind of modeled along the Antarctic Treaty that was back from, I think, the 50s. But when you start getting into these more kind of specific areas of law, like interpersonal treatment and so forth, I mean, we don't even really have a working agreement on basic human rights in space because it's an international thing. So
yeah.
The U.S. has its set of concerns. Russia has theirs. China will certainly have theirs because they're spacefaring now, and they've got people coming back and forth from orbit. So, you know, how do you iron that out? I mean, we will assume that access to oxygen and water and a place to use the toilet are basic human rights. But beyond that, it starts getting kind of sticky. So if you're talking about, let's say, there's a male-female couple from different nationalities in orbit and a claim of harassment is made, or maybe they're male-to-male, whatever the case may be, whose law does that fall under? The U.S. is going to make one set of claims based on our sensitivities here. And China or Russia or India or some other country would have their sensibilities and their legal statutes. So it's going to be really interesting seeing how this moves forward. And the only thing I've seen in terms of parallels that people are talking about at this point are, you know, looking at activities and concerns from long-term space simulations and people stationed in Antarctic bases, nuclear submarines and things like that, where you do start seeing aggression and occasionally sexual crimes and theft and those kind of things happen. So we've had a really good run with well-behaved astronauts for decades, but that's not going to last forever.
Yeah, no, well, that's the interesting thing, is that this wasn't, you know, the amount of training and the amount of things that an astronaut would have to go through, you know, not just physically. You know, you're vetting these guys like crazy before they're allowed to go out into space. So, like a space crime or bad behavior in space wasn't really a big deal back when those laws were written up, correct?
Yeah, and although it was thought about at that point, there hadn't been much. That was 98. Since then, since the ISS started being occupied full time in 2000, there was at least one documented case of an astronaut. This wasn't a crime thing, but an astronaut going into a pretty severe depression and pulling away from everybody and displaying some troubling symptoms that got the doctors very concerned about possibly bringing, I think it was a him back earlier and so forth. And, of course, that's when you start getting concerned about possible, you know, actions of malfeasance as well. But in that case, nothing happened. But, you know, people snap all the time. I mean, I personally, if somebody locked me in something the size of a cargo container for 6 months, I'd just be banging off the walls, you know, going nuts anyway. So I would be a really bad candidate for an astronaut.
Yeah.
So like you say, they vet those people carefully, but you don't know how people are going to change or what kind of problems they might have. I mean, you could have somebody who would have a small stroke that wouldn't be diagnosed or something, and behaviors can change. So, yeah, it really is kind of the Wild West.
Yeah. Well, what's happening now with her? What's legally happening with her now? Is she still at the space station?
Yeah, she's not going anywhere. It's a 6 month tour. They're not going to fly her home for this. So the NASA's, I think the Office of the Inspector General is looking into it. The FTC is either going to look into it or refer it. And at this point, they said we're just looking into it, but it's not a big immediate concern because it was, as far as I can tell, a one shot deal. And it's just something that, you know, she's been said, don't do it, told not to do it again. And we'll look into this and try and figure it out. So, like I said, I don't think this will turn into that big a thing. I'm kind of surprised it came up at all. It kind of feels to me like a little bit of a look how I can call you out in the public eye kind of thing from the estranged spouse, because it didn't have to be referred to NASA. This is something that could have been handled by attorneys, but now it's big and noisy. And of course, it makes a great news story because if you put the word space or tactical or moist before any other word or term, it suddenly becomes more newsworthy, right? That's I think what made it so sexy to the press.
Got it. Now, well, it's interesting. Interesting story. Brings up a lot of thoughts that we just had a conversation about for sure. Hey, Rod, hang on, okay?
You got it.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He's our space expert. He's the best. He's an author, a journalist. He's written about 800 books. He is a space expert. So if you want to jump in here with any space related questions or comments, the phone lines are open and the text lines are open. It's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We'll take a break here and come back and jump right back into the conversation with Rod Pyle here on 720 WGN. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the WGN Skyline Studios here on Wacker in downtown Chicago. We're live till 5 a.m., and that's when you can hear me, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your request in now, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call or text if you have any space questions, space-related questions or concerns. It's 312-981-7200 because Rod Pyle is with us, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. You can check out pylebooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page as well at facebook.com/NickDShow. Let's get Rod back on the air. Hey, Rod, welcome back.
Hey there.
All right. So SpaceX's Starhopper. It completed its final test flight. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it didn't last long, did it? I was kind of surprised. I probably should have paid more attention to it. But so originally it was built, I think it first showed up about a year ago, and it looked very much like a V2 or a cartoon rocket, a big silver kind of banana shaped thing, very handsome, looked like a rocket. And then they had a storm. This is out in Boca Chica, Texas, where they're testing the thing, I guess. And they had a storm And because it was basically what the it's designed to do hover and approach and landing tests for the Raptor engine, which is SpaceX's new high power methane liquid oxygen engine. So it's really just a test bed. It doesn't matter how it looked, but it looked pretty cool. And then a storm came along and knocked off the top part of it because it was just made of sheets of a hollow stainless steel. So Elon said, oh, it doesn't matter. They just put this kind of dome top on it. So it looked like, if you saw the video, it looked like a flying water tank, kind of almost like the, you'd see in a rural community or something. But it completed the top, went up to 500 feet about, which is what the FAA had restricted it to. And it only lasted about a minute, but that's all they needed. So I guess this is going to be parked and used as a static test stand now for engines, which makes sense. What I think is actually even cooler is they're now building Starhopper Mark 1 and Mark 2, which are going to be the new variants of this. They're going to have three or more of these engines, and they'll be intended for near or orbital flight. But what I think is really kind of neat, which Musk is doing, which is so Elon Musk, is he's having these two different versions done by different divisions of his company to encourage internal competition. So as if his management style wasn't enough to make it happen, he's got these guys competing internally, and I think that's pretty clever.
Wow. Okay. All right. Who names these things?
I think he does, because they change, as you know, the Big Falcon rocket was originally what this is building up to. This test stand is for the Big Falcon rocket, which before that was the Interplanetary Colonial Transporter, and now it's called Starship, and the first stage is the Falcon Ultra Heavy, and, you know, I'm sure it'll change again before the thing actually flies, but, you know, this is a guy who sells flamethrowers online and digs tunnels under Los Angeles because he thinks it's cool, and now he just came out with a line of Nuke Mars t-shirts because he's been talking in the media about, hey, if we want to terraform Mars quickly, let's just set off a bunch of nuclear bombs over the poles and melt the ice caps, and, you know, it'll give it a denser atmosphere. And there's just some reason to think that that may be right, but people just, it leaves a real bad taste in your mouth when people talk about using nuclear weapons on other planets.
Yeah, that may, that's a little strange. That's a little strange. But, so Elon Musk sells flamethrowers. I love
Did you see him?
I'm sorry?
Did you see him when he brought him out?
No, I didn't.
It was just one of these things. You know, at least the Nuke Mars t-shirts kind of relate to SpaceX.
Yeah.
This was just, he wanted to sell flamethrowers. He thought it would be cool. And I think it shoots about 15 feet or something. It comes with all the appropriate warning stickers and so forth. But, I mean, these are worse than the toys you and I grew up with, which were pretty dangerous already.
Yeah.
You could shoot plastic bullets in your sister's eye or something.
Yeah.
And I've got a flamethrower. That's a bit much.
I remember, dangerous toys, man. It's amazing. It's amazing that people around my age or your age have survived. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
We would have, like, chemistry sets and... How about this one? How about the wood-burning kit? You remember the wood-burning kit?
Yeah. Right? Oh, it worked really good on the palm of your hand,
exactly.
Too.
That's just, it's basically you're giving a seven-year-old a soldering iron. I know.
And do you remember, did you ever have a Gilbert chemistry set?
I did.
Did they still have the magnesium strips in it when you got it?
Yes, they did.
Boy, those things burn like nothing else, right?
Yeah. No,
what else are you going to do with
it? Tom is in shock. Tom's young. He's 25. So yeah. He doesn't know that that's for real.
That is so dangerous.
No, that's for real.
That is blindingly dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is blindingly dangerous. And of course, if you drop it, you go, oh, that really hurts. I'm burning my thigh. You know, I'm going to put it out with water.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't do anything. It just keeps burning.
Yeah.
And there were no, as I recall, because this was a big metal box with little bottles that, you know, had sulfur and magnesium and everything but gunpowder. Although you can make gunpowder.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And, but there weren't really any instructions not to do that.
Right.
They assumed a certain level of parental involvement. And I don't know about you, but my parents were out making a living. They didn't have time to worry about that stuff.
Oh, yeah. Like, no.
Okay. Have fun with your chemistry set. Don't hurt your sister. You know?
Yeah. Well, I've talked about, you know, like just like playing outside in the 70s was dangerous. We would, if I didn't come home with a cut, it wasn't a successful day. You know,
well, if we didn't have at least one experience with a puddle of gasoline and a bunch of matches crammed into a metal pipe trying to make a rocket, I didn't consider it to be a successful day. And I still can't believe that nobody got hurt. I do know one guy who was experimenting with rocketry as a young lad who actually, they had an explosion and a friend of his died.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, stuff like that did happen. But fortunately, most of the toys that Mattel and Gilbert and Marx and those guys put out look more dangerous than they were. But, yeah, you're right. Occasionally, I mean, creepy crawlers. Remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Goofy oven?
Yep. Yep.
You could put a real singe on the side of your face with that. You, younger members of your audience are listening going, what are these two old duffers talking about?
Yeah,
I don't remember any of that.
You know, and then, you know, you had Shrinky Dinks, which is that's when the kids can play with the oven. Another thing.
Oh, those are the little plastic things that you cooked and they shrunk. Yeah,
that's another thing. Is they were plastic, you'd put them in the oven, which is just weird to put something plastic in an oven and cook it. And then just to have like an 8-year-old trying to deal with an oven just seems wrong. But that was par for the course, though, man. I mean,
and they were really hot when they came out. They could burn you very nicely. Thank you very much.
Yeah,
and do you remember the? I don't want to go on about this all night, but do you remember the Whammo Air Blaster?
Oh, sure. Yeah,
and you know, kids would put that up their friend's ear and go, look at this pop," and there goes your eardrum. You know, I mean, who thought about that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
I didn't.
Yeah, nobody thought about that. All right, Rod, hang out, okay.
All right.
Rod Pyle is with us. We were reminiscing about dangerous toys. That's for real, Tom. That was for real.
Is the mascot of the 70s a kid with just like an eye patch and a missing hand or something?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. It was fun, man.
I'm sure it was. It does sound like fun.
Everybody hang on. If you guys, if you're on hold, hold on a second. We got to take a break here. We got the news coming up, and then we're going to come back and talk more with Rod about space. We have more space stories to talk about, and if you guys want to jump in with any comments or if you have questions space-related, it's 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200 for more with Rod Pyle. And again, you can check out his, we have a link on our Facebook page if you want to check out his website, look at his books and all that cool stuff. That's facebook.com/NickDShow. And you can also go directly to pilebooks.com. That's P-Y-L-E, pilebooks.com. All right, let's take a break here. The news is coming up right after this. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we're live in the WGN Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. We're here every morning from 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5. Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. It's Thursday, AAA Thursday. We'll get to that a little bit later. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Joining us right now is Rod Pyle, author, journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine. He is a space expert. We're talking all things space. If you guys have a question, a space-related question or a comment, Rod's here live. He'll be happy to answer it for you. You can talk or text us right now at 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you. So I have a question for you.
Yeah.
What do you think of what you've seen for the movie Ad Astra so far?
It looks weird.
I'm not quite
sure what to make of it just yet. It looks a little strange. This is the new Brad Pitt movie that comes out at the end of September, September 20th. It comes out, but I'm not sure what I'm not sure what to make of it just yet. But what about you? What did you think?
Well, same thing. You know, I saw the ad for it. Of course, it caught my eye because I thought, oh, that's the same name as the magazine I work on. That'll get us a few search hits. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I looked at the trailer, and then I was kind of scratching my head. I thought, okay, so he's going after Dad at the ends of the solar system. Dad went off to look for alien life, and from what I saw, clips of Tommy Lee Jones, that movie, it looks like he not only found it, but possibly became alien life. But that's another story.
Yeah.
But using technology that looks very kind of 1970s, you know, chemical rockets and old-fashioned-looking spacesuits and helmets and stuff. So there's obviously some kind of a, you know, visual theme, some kind of jive that the art director got their head wrapped around. That's fine. And Matthew McConaughey's not in it, so I consider that a big win right up front. Just had to say it.
I know.
But it feels a little bit like Interstellar in that it's got this kind of slightly off-kilter, rangy sort of big concept script idea. And what I've been able to read, so I saw the trailer, I looked it up on Wiki, and then I looked it up on IMDb, and I kept looking it up, and I was looking for a plot description that would really kind of tell me what it was about. And so far, none of them have really.
Yeah, no, it's I've seen the commercials for it. I've seen the trailer, and I looked at the IMDb page, and I still can't make heads or tails out of what it's really about. I do not know.
We know he's on Earth. Pitt's on Earth. He's an astronaut. He's been doing a great job. It's the height of his career. And then the next thing you see him climbing what looks like a space elevator going up, you know, near to orbit or in orbit. And something bad happens and it goes kaboom. And now he's falling and falling and falling and starting to heat up. And then they cut to him waking up in an infirmary. And the big general who comes stomping in says, "We have a secret mission." And the next thing you know, there's Donald Sutherland, because there's always Donald Sutherland in these movies.
Yeah.
And so I really, and then that's kind of it. You know, you don't see anything what's happening beyond that. So I'm looking forward to it, but because I think Pitt's great. I mean, he's really aged into his skills incredibly well. I just saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood last weekend, and that was sensational.
Yeah.
But I'm scratching my head on this one.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll agree on this one.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I love the fact that Donald Sutherland is in it, because Donald Sutherland was, of course, in Space Cowboys. The Clint Eastwood movie, and that's a movie that I really love. Now, how do you feel about Space Cowboys?
The problem is they always get the shuttle technology wrong, and the physics are kind of messed up in the places they go to.
Yeah.
You know, so the landings and should there be more gravity? Should there be less gravity? Would there be ice volcanoes? Is it dangerous? How is this space shuttle continuing to blast along when it no longer has an external fuel tank and no internal fuel supply, that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
But, and I don't remember, I'm probably getting it mixed up with Armageddon, because they were kind of, oh, forgive me for saying this in advance, they were kind of a similar class in my mind.
Oh, wow.
yeah, I know.
Yeah, no, I actually really love Space Cowboys, and I hate Armageddon.
Hate Armageddon?
Oh, yeah, I hate that movie. I hate that
because,
movie. My producer likes it, but I can't stand that movie.
It's an American masterpiece.
Did you hate it because of the kind of posturing and all that?
Oh yeah, I mean it's Michael Bay at his bayest, you know. and I mean the movie. Yeah. I just think this is so stupid. And I'm not a fan of Armageddon. Space Cowboys. Tommy Lee Jones is in that too, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Tommy Lee Jones and Donald Sutherland. Right. Okay. And who was he? So it was Clint? Wasn't there a fourth? Was there a fourth Space Cowboy, or am I nuts? Because I know it was.
No,
it was,
I think you're right.
Clint, Donald Sutherland.
I don't remember who it was.
Tommy Lee Jones, and I can't remember who. I can't remember who the fourth one was. Maybe somebody knows. I don't know.
James Garner.
There you go.
Yeah.
There it is, James Garner. Yeah,
I mean, how can you miss with that cast?
No, know? It's a great cast, and I thought it was a very entertaining movie, and I loved all of the, you know, Rod. I loved all of the stuff that they had, you know, the tests that they had to go through, and I thought all that stuff was really funny with the old guys going through the training and everything.
Yeah, and I was in a particularly sour mood about that time that movie came out, so I should probably give it another viewing, because it's been a long time.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's probably better than I remember it being.
Well, so, we'll find out about Ad Astra. Now, what about this other one? Have you seen the trailer for Lucy in the Sky?
No, I don't know anything about it. Tell me.
That's a new movie with Natalie Portman, and she plays an astronaut. And this is another one that's being very vague about what it's about. Guy who wrote and directed it is the guy behind Fargo, the TV show Fargo. And so I'm interested in that, because I love that show, and I think he's a very interesting writer and director. I'm not really certain about what it's about. She seems to have gone into space and changed when she came back. Like something weird happened.
Huh.
John Hamm is in it as well.
Cool.
Yeah, so here's what it says. It says astronaut Lucy Cola returns to Earth after a transcendent experience during a mission to space and begins to lose touch with reality in a world that now seems too small. So that's what it's about.
It's kind of broad, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's
interesting. Maybe, I mean, so do you think it's a psychological drama?
That's what
growing tentacles or something.
No. I don't think there's any sort of like weird like body changing in it. I just think that she is affected deeply by what she did on this mission, and it really starts to affect her personality. And it's got Natalie Portman, John Hamm, Zazie Beetz, Chicago's own Nick Offerman, Ellen Burstyn. So it's a really good cast. And the director
is a good cast.
And the director is responsible for the TV show, one of the best TV shows on television. And so I'm really curious about it, and I hope it works out. And that one comes out in October.
Well, that sounds good. Now, what have you heard about Picard?
I don't. Which one is this now?
So Picard is
Picard. Yeah. Oh, right.
Star Trek. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Is that on All Access or is that
All Access?
So it's CBS All Access.
Yeah, it's on All Access.
Yeah.
It looks interesting, and he looks great, and of course he's a great actor. But I just wonder what they're going to do with it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. I will say this: a lot of people seem to be very excited about it. Because, you know, obviously he has a lot of fans. Patrick Stewart's got a lot of fans.
Oh, yeah.
And so people are just...
Every time he walked into a scene, your eyes just went there and suddenly just tuned out everybody else shot, right?
Yeah. And I mean, Star Trek Next Generation is intensely loved by people. And I think a lot of people are very excited about Picard. Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
That's going to be exciting. I can't wait. And it's great to see somebody... Not that I got a personal stake in it or anything, but it's great to see somebody older getting a role like that in television.
Sure.
So it's not always she's 22,
right?
White hot and the very best we've got.
Yeah.
Like, well, how does anybody get to be the very best at something when they're 22? But that's television.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of Patrick Stewart. I particularly liked him. I mean, I like him in everything, but I particularly liked him in Logan with Hugh Jackman, which is, I think, a pretty magnificent movie and a really great movie. It's my favorite comic book movie. I just think it's an amazing film, and he's great in it. So, hey, we got somebody on the line here. Our old buddy Doc has a question for you. Hey, Doc, go ahead.
Hey, I love it when Rob's on. But let me first say that it's now Professor McConaughey. So
that's right. You heard about that, right? Matthew McConaughey is now a professor at University of Texas.
Of what?
He's teaching a script to screen screenplay class.
Okay, well, let me just say, if I may, since I have a background in academia, I believe he's probably an adjunct lecturer, but
I'll
look it up just to make sure.
Yeah.
Professor might be. But,
hey, I still have a relevant question, though.
Okay.
Here on Earth, you know, our politicians will politicize everything on our environment. I don't think we can get any consensus among scientists and the Paris Climate Accord. And when it comes to what's happening now with our air, melting of water on the caps, 60 Minutes just reran this story about the effect and magnitude of plastics and what that's doing to birds and fish.
Yeah.
My question is, are we getting any data from space and our work up there and from all these satellites that would help us better understand the nature of what we're doing to our planet and the magnitude that might help us get a better consensus of what is going on and what we could possibly be doing?
That's a good question. That's a great question, Doc. What do you think, Rod?
That's an excellent question. I'm so glad you asked it. So I have a particular viewpoint on this, I guess, because of the time I spent working up at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is NASA's field center on the West Coast here, which is devoted all to robotics and Earth observation and deep space exploration. So, yeah, there's a ton of data. And I mean, most of the data we have, really, really good, solid, overarching data and observations on climate change and global warming and so forth, come from orbit. Low Earth orbit, and some from geosynchronous orbit, some from the space station. And when you start talking to folks at NASA about this, the news isn't particularly good, and there isn't a lot of disagreement. They may disagree on what the causes are, but the effects are pretty clear. Glaciers are melting, CO2 levels are rising. There's concern about these things called clathrates up in the Arctic tundra that are these big methane reserves that may start to melt and open up, and so on and so on and so on. The disagreement is on the political end, and when Trump came into office, for better or worse, depending on your point of view, one of the first things that was done in the new NASA budget was to literally start turning off Earth observation missions because that data was no longer deemed as being important, irrelevant, or necessary. To the extent that there was one instrument on the space station that was already installed, already running, already observing the Earth. It's completely passive. It cost about $1.8 million per year to run with an M, not a B. So it cost almost nothing. And that was cut in that incoming NASA budget, which I calculated actually that amount of money was about the cost of Secret Service for a weekend at Mar-a-Lago, just coincidentally.
Yeah.
So to not ramble too much, the answer is yes, there's a lot of really good data. Yes, it does give us a lot of information that would help to understand how to better solve the problem. You see it in the news this week with these Amazon fires. Those are all observed and charted and documented from orbit. The question is, what are we going to do about it? Who's going to pay for it? And how can we get the politicians to agree?
Right.
But the science is pretty solid.
Yeah, no, and Doc, yeah, I mean that's a great question, but man, everything is
thanks for it.
Everything is politicized, Doc.
I'm wondering when do we get to a point of no return? Because as important as the air is, you know, we as organisms are a large percent water, and our planet is a large percent water. And just watching this thing on 60 Minutes about these countries that are just putting trash in the rivers, letting it flow into the ocean, and then it's breaking down, and I could see that getting to a point of no return.
Yeah.
And then the damage that's wreaking on both fish, the coral reefs, birds, I mean, that's really scary.
It is scary stuff. It is scary stuff. Doc,
it's all scary, yeah.
Doc, I appreciate your call, man. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Doc.
All right, there's Doc. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is here. We got to take a break. We'll come back. More questions for Rod, space-related otherwise, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Always love it when Rod Pyle is here. We have a link to our to his website on our Facebook page, too, so make sure you check that out. There's a starman waiting in the sky. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. It's Triple Play Thursday, and that'll be coming up a little bit later on. That's One Artist, Three Songs, 312-981-7200. We are going to talk about some of the best album covers of all time. We lost a great local artist. Pedro Bell passed away, who did a lot of beautiful pieces and also designed really cool and iconic album covers for Funkadelic and other artists. So we thought we would talk about some of the best album covers of all time. Weird World Records also coming up this morning, and our phone number is 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle is with us. If you have any space-related questions or concerns, anything about that, we would love to hear from you. Either talk or text us at 312-981-7200. Here is Rod. Rod is back. Hey, Rod.
Thanks. How are you doing?
All right. So let's talk about the humanoid robot that the Russians had delivered to the space station. Let's talk about that.
So there was a Soyuz that launched last week, and they tried to do a docking. And Soyuz is used to carry both crews and cargo to the International Space Station. In this case, it was actually an uncrewed Soyuz that was just carrying cargo. And the reason they did that, usually they use a different spacecraft called Progress, which has this multiple backup automatic docking system and remote control in case the automatic systems fail and all that. But they were testing this new rocket for the manned version of the Soyuz, the crewed version. So they said, okay, let's just load it up with cargo as long as we want to test it without people in it, and we'll go ahead and make a run up to the space station. So they did that. The docking was not successful, the automated docking, and they didn't have a remote control backup. So the short version of the story is they had to move another Soyuz capsule to open up a different docking port that has a different docking system, and they finally got it docked. Mm-hmm. So, yay, that's good. On board is the Fedor F-850 Skybot, which looks kind of like a more aluminized version of the Terminator a little bit.
Oh, wow.
His outside skin's been burned off. I mean, it's not that scary looking, but it is very humanoid. Now, this isn't the first robot up at the space station. They had the Robonaut 1 and Robonaut 2, which were built by NASA and General Motors, which were roughly humanoid. And they had, I think we talked a couple of installments ago about the Astro Bees, which are these little kind of like cube-shaped robots that fly around with fans inside the space station and deliver tools and do observation and that kind of stuff. But Fedor, this F-850 robot, looks like a 6-foot-tall, scary robot. And it's they term it a social companion, whatever that means. No, not what you're thinking. And it the idea is it can work with human tools in conditions that humans would normally do but might be too dangerous or too routine to waste an astronaut's time on, or maybe it's too risky to go somewhere. So because they have hands and feet and legs and all that, they can actually adapt to whatever it is that humans normally use. What was really kind of chilling about it, if you saw the video, was they're showing this thing stomping around and looking at people and mimicking human movement and all that. They have a shot, only in Russia, they have a shot with this robot with two handguns on a firing range, knocking out targets one after the other perfectly. I mean, he didn't miss a single shot. There's shells flying everywhere. The guys operating them are grinning ear to ear. And I thought, you know, NASA wouldn't do that. That's very much a Russian space agency thing.
That's funny. That's really funny. I'm looking at a picture of him. I just Googled image. He's a little creepy. Yeah. He's a little creepy looking. I really want to see the footage of him, you know, shooting guns. That's
yeah. And you know, as creepy as any humanoid robot is that doesn't have skin or anything, at least if you give him two fake eyes, you can kind of relate to it. But it's this big head with just one eye.
Yeah,
which makes it even a little spookier.
It is.
So yeah, you wouldn't want him to get upset. And you know, I think they still carry a firearm on the Soyuz. It's locked in the Soyuz capsule, but it's designed in case they have an emergency landing and unexpectedly rugged area where there might be bears or something.
Yeah.
So they carry a firearm that has never been used, obviously, in flight. But, you know, that robot's a little gun-happy. You might want to guard your pistol on the spacecraft.
And how long is Mr. Skybot F-850 going to be up there?
I think a couple of years, unless there's a breakdown. They had Robonaut up there from 2011 to, I think, 2014, then had to bring it around for refurbishment because it was having some problems, because these things are experimental and they're working with zero-G, so the stresses and torques and stuff are different. But again, it's an experiment, and you know, we'll see how effective it is. It's kind of interesting because these things are big and bulky, and the space station is not that roomy an environment, so you kind of wonder, I don't know where they keep them, you know, and when they're operating. I guess that's just part of their experiment load for that day, so you just make room for it. But you'd think something that could kind of be a little more compact or roll up on itself or something would make more sense. But they don't ask me, so I don't tell them.
There you go. All right. Well, if you want to see Skybot, just give them a little Google image search. It's pretty interesting. Rod, hang out, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. He's great. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine for the National Space Society. He's a space expert. You can check out pylebooks.com to see all of his stuff. If you have any questions concerning space-related stuff, text or call us right now at 312-981-7200. Going to hit the news right after this.
Going down, welcome to the Space Jam. Here's your chance, do your dance at the Space Jam. All right.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago, and we are talking with Rod Pyle. He's a space expert, author, has written several books, and is answering your questions, and we're talking about some space stories in the news and much more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk and text if you want to join us. Let's get back to our conversation with Rod. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks.
All right. Here's a weird question that we have from the 803 or 804 area code who texted this in.
Okay.
Does the space station use a Roomba?
Not that I know of. They have to because you dust doesn't settle and dirt doesn't sit on the floor like it does when you've got a 1G full gravity environment. So all the dust and dirt just kind of floats around and stays in the air. So most of it's picked up by filtration in their air recirculation system, but they do have little handheld vacuum cleaners where they can go into crevices and stuff. So, you know, if somebody's, I don't know, eating a cracker or a piece of toast or something, which they probably don't allow in there. But anyway, if somebody's got something with crumbs in a corner and they need to go get them out of there, they've got little mini vacuum cleaners they can use. And in fact, I was reading a couple months ago, I was looking up for another one of these interviews about the benefits of the space program. I realized the original battery-powered dust buster has some connective tissue descended from one that was designed for lunar module because of how much moon dust they were afraid was going to be in there. And they, coming in with the astronauts after the moonwalks, and they didn't want to foul the switches and all that kind of stuff. So they had a little, there was an early version of the dustbuster.
Oh.
The lunar module.
Oh. Yeah. All right. Well, there you go. So no Roombas necessary. All right.
No Roombas. But the Astrobees are kind of like that. They just don't have vacuum cleaners. But they do fly around robotically and check on things and observe, you know, pieces of equipment in the space station and so forth. They're kind of like a Roomba. Yeah.
All right. Very cool. Okay. Here's Paul on WGN. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Nick. On the space station, how much spare time do they have?
Not much. Actually, I think we talked about this in one of the last couple of segments on the show. Up to half their time is spent at this point just doing maintenance and routine preventive maintenance and repair chores because the station's almost 20 years old. So between that and trying to keep up their load of science experiments, and they also have to exercise up to 2 hours per day just to keep their bodies from falling apart because there's no gravity there. So, yeah, their schedules are really filled. So when they do get a few minutes to go float up and look out the window at Earth or something, it's very precious time. It's a good question.
Wow. Okay.
Do they get satellite TV?
I don't know if they get satellite TV, but they do get feeds from NASA. So they do have media feeds. They can get the internet. There's a certain amount of programming and obviously audio that they can get. They can make phone calls. They can talk to families. They often will call down to school classrooms and have live chats with kids in certain jurisdictions. It's kind of a gift from NASA to the community. But again, there isn't much time, so usually if they're not working or eating, they're wrapped up in their sleeping bags trying to catch a few winks so they can be at it the next day.
Wow. All right.
Okay.
Thanks, Paul. Good question.
I bet.
All right.
Thanks, Paul.
All right. Here's Donald on WGN. Hey, Donald.
Hey. My question is about teleportation. I've read that the scientists have worked with this and that they've been able to teleport particles, maybe even if they're microscopic, the particles using some quantum physics where a thing can be on Earth and then be out in space and then maybe back again. Is this technology being explored possible? It's sort of like the last of the Star Trek things, you know.
So, is teleportation at all feasible?
It's one of those things that always feels like a bridge too far in science, you know. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a book called Blueprint for Battlestar, which is all about the science of sci-fi, and that was actually one of the first chapters that the publisher and I started talking about. I looked and looked and looked and looked and read and scratched my head and talked to people, and I finally had to bail on the chapter because it was just too far away. So apparently there had been some work done, I think here and in China, where people were claiming that there had been some basic teleportation, as you say, on a quantum level, but exactly how it worked, I don't remember. I do remember that it was something where I think if you were going to move a 1-inch cube of metal, it would take 2,000 years or something like that to do it. So it's not practical yet. They're obviously at the very, very earliest stages of this, and what the future is, I certainly don't know, and that's why I had to toss the chapter out. So I'm sorry I can't give you a better answer, but it is just at the very barest beginning.
Okay. All right, Donald, thanks for the call. If you're going to do the teleportation thing, make sure you don't get into the pod with a fly. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, and don't mistake their microwave for the transporter, because that's a bad afternoon,
right.
Too.
Yeah, exactly. So you wrote a little piece here that I have in front of me about Sweating Rockets. That was a band I was in, I think, in college. what is Sweating Rockets?
So this is another Elon Musk story. So he's trying to find ways for this big Starship rocket, which is going to be flying, we hope, to Mars and eventually and landing on Mars and then coming back and landing on Earth. Mars is a tough place to go because it's got enough gravity and just enough atmosphere to be pesky, but not enough atmosphere to really make parachutes work the way we like them to work and slow down an incoming spacecraft enough. So you have to use rockets when you're trying to land, but you also have this period of time where you're just coming in like the shuttle used to on a heat shield. And because he wants Starship to be reusable, he's trying to figure out a way not to use a blade of heat shields, which is what it's called that they use on the Apollo capsules and the Orion.
Yeah.
The new spacecraft. The shuttle used heat tiles, but they're really delicate and they're expensive and all that. So the long and short of it is, he said, okay, let's look back at some old NASA and Air Force technology and experiments. And one of them was drilling little tiny holes all over the hull of the spacecraft and pumping fluid, whether it be water or methane from the fuel supply or some other liquid out, that vaporizes the second it exits the spacecraft and forms this kind of, it's not really a heat barrier, it carries the heat away with it as it's traveling through the heat of the atmosphere. So, in fact, the rocket is actually sweating. And it was researched, as I said, by the Air Force and NASA in the 50s and 60s, looked promising, but, you know, we were in a hurry to get to the moon, so we just went with these burn-off heat shields that we made. But there was actually one, and I can't confirm this because I could only get two sources, but there was one program that NASA was going to use in a space capsule for a single astronaut, this method for coming home, which would include mixing the astronaut's urine with whatever water was left over in the system to create this vapor heat shield for the spacecraft. So you'd actually have a pea-cooled spacecraft,
which wow.
I thought was a pretty cool idea. I mean, that's recycling taken to the max.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely.
The only thing, so the problem that they're concerned about is if any of these pores get clogged across a reasonably sized area, you'd have a bald spot when you're reentering, and you could have a burn through. So people were asking, well, what might do that? Well, if you're landing on Mars and sitting there for a while, Martian dust could clog the pores. So you'd have to keep pumping air or liquid or something through them to make sure they're all clear. But as one engineer pointed out, he said, you know, on Earth, while you're sitting there waiting for launch, all it takes is a couple of seagulls dropping their package on the rocket, and it could seal up an area maybe 3 inches by 10 inches long, which is enough to cause a burn through. So they got a lot of work to do.
Wow. All right. Oh, man. Elon Musk is just busy, man.
He's busy, and he's inventive as hell. And one thing I'll say is, you know, he doesn't dawdle. If the technology that he's trying to do isn't working, he'll hammer on it for a while, and then he just says, okay, that's enough. I'm pivoting. And that's something that's hard for government agencies to do, you know,
because
there's tons of paperwork and things to go through. When Elon changes his mind, you know, if he says, I don't want to make Starship out of composite anymore, I want to make it out of stainless steel because it's lighter and looks cooler, boom, decision made. He just goes and does it.
Yeah.
So that's pretty neat.
Yeah. All right. He's an interesting guy.
Oh, yeah.
And you've met him.
I have not, actually. I've met his next in command, the president of the company, a woman named Gwynne Shotwell, who's incredibly interesting and intelligent. But I saw Elon outside the door talking to people. By the time I got out, he was gone, so I missed my chance to meet him. So one of these days. So that is one of my goals.
There you go. All right.
He'll probably look at me and say, hello, insect, or something like that.
Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. We got a few more minutes with him here till 3 o'clock. And if you want to jump in, it's 312-981-7200. Talk or text any questions that are space-related. 312-981-7200. More with Rod after this on 720 WGN. Right. Welcome back, everyone. How you doing? It's Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Skyline studio here. We are here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5 and Steve Cochran at 6 with your morning drive. We lost a really great artist. Pedro Bell passed away, and he was the guy who did some iconic album covers for Parliament Funkadelic. So we're going to jump into the best album covers of all time. And we might even get into the worst, because there's a couple of websites out there that show some of the weirdest and worst album covers of all time. So maybe we'll look that up, too. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, we're here. Rod Pyle is with us. You can check out Pyle Books, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com. There's a link on our Facebook page. He's an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine for the National Space Society. And he joins us usually once a month to talk space. Rod, welcome back.
Thanks, sir.
All right. We have another question here. Steve is on WGN. Hi, Steve.
How you doing?
All right.
Awesome show, as always. My question is, do they now or will they ever have a webcam that people can, you know, like the general public can go on and check and see possibly, but not necessarily the secret things they're doing, or, you know, just where they can observe what's going on at the space station?
At the space station. So like a webcam? Do they have the
like a webcam, you can go check it out, see like what's going on, and, you know.
Yeah.
So in other words, make the space station like a reality show kind of thing, right?
Yeah. Big Brother in space. So, yeah.
So they kind of have that. If you go on NASA TV, which is usually a good thing to do right about the time you're getting ready to go to bed, because it'll help you get to sleep. Sorry, NASA, but it's often not very interesting. But one thing they do, they will often have an image from the station looking down on Earth. It's just this slow rotating planet below you. And then they do schedule, they have scheduled broadcasts from inside the station. But in terms of the public stream that goes out, there is not a continuous monitoring of what's going on inside, because those guys want their privacy too.
Yeah.
I think Mission Control has, so there's two major mission controls. One is in the U.S. and one is in Russia. They both have full-time video feeds of the common areas and some of the technical areas, but I don't think of crew quarters. That I'm not sure of. But as far as public consumption, sorry, you can't tune in whenever you want.
There you go. All right, Steve, thanks for the question. So astronomers find a bizarre planet that they say is unlike any other discovered so far. What's going on there?
Yeah, so with the whimsical name of HR 5183b, not that weird. It's a super Jupiter, so it's, I think, like three Jupiter masses orbiting a star. But what they discovered that's kind of weird about it was that it's got this really strange, like, egg-shaped orbit. So it goes way, way, way out from the host star and then comes way, way, way back in. And we're used to seeing orbits like that in our own solar system for comets, but not for planets. So that was the main part of that story that was kind of interesting. So it's got this 50 to 100-year orbit. And again, you know, there's a lot of – this is real Sherlock Holmes stuff, because the way – you're not seeing this planet because it's many, many light years away. You're looking at the wobbling of the star ever so slightly, I mean, micro degrees back and forth, and guessing based on that, or inferring based on that, it's not a guess, but inferring based on that, that there's a star orbiting it that causes that motion, a planet orbiting that star that causes that wobbling of the star. So that's the extent they have to go through to try and figure out what is going on with exoplanets. And it just blows my mind that it works. But
yeah.
But they have found a few that they were able to later confirm using other methodologies. This is one of the earlier methodologies they had, because it's a lot easier to measure a star wobbling than it is to do other kind of observations. So it's the first one they used.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, another one of these things they named it HR 5183b.
Yeah.
What's HR 5183? Is there an HR 5381A?
Probably. Well, B is the planet name. So HR 5183 is the star system.
Oh, okay.
And then B is the planet. So, yeah, these names come from the, the IAC, I think, the International Astronomical Congress, I believe it is. And, you know, NASA will submit names for things they discover. And there's a size limit. So you only go down to, I think, small craters or something on Mars or the Moon. And then if it gets much smaller than that, the IAC doesn't have oversight, which is why on the Mars missions they can get away with naming rocks goofy things like Scooby-Doo and Muskrat and Molehill and that kind of thing.
Right.
And they actually don't name them after copyrighted characters anymore, because sometime in the early 2000s, somebody in the NASA legal team woke up one morning and thought, hey, we could be a copyright violation for this. These Hanna-Barbera names you've been appropriating. It never happened, but so now they named them after, like, boring geological sites on Earth and stuff like that. Well, they're interesting to geologists. But anyway, yeah, so as we start discovering really cool exoplanets, and especially if we find one, you know, that we think we see a signature, ultimately when we have a big enough telescope, we might see a signature of something that looks like life in the atmosphere, we're going to have to come up with better names.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't do a public lottery, because you get stuff like Planet McPlanet Face and that kind of stuff. So you're going to have to do a little better. You know, maybe school kids, they seem to take it a little more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now, the last thing we want to talk about was this another rover to look for life on Mars. Tell us about this one.
So we got the Mars 2020 rover, which I think is still getting an official name. That's NASA. That's going up in 2020. And that's going to have a small core sampling drill, which is different than the drill that went up with Curiosity and landed in a different area and do some basic life science. But the one you're talking about is the ExoMars rover, which is from the European Space Agency. And that's launching in 2020 and landing in 2021, so not too far off from when the NASA one is landing. It's named Rosalind Franklin, who was a pioneer in DNA research.
Okay.
And it's an unashamedly astrobiology mission. So really the first one since the Vikings in the 1970s, the first landers we sent up there from the U.S., and the first successful ones, machines to land on the planet and operate. And it's good, you know, no holds barred, looking for life. So they're going to drive around. They've got a drill that can go down to, I think, 6 feet, which
wow.
is pretty remarkable.
Wow.
The rover.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you got to stand still 6.5 feet. And that's, you know, we'll see. I mean, we thought we had the same thing, similar idea going with the Mars InSight that had a self-hammering drill mechanism that has gotten hung up on rocks. So we'll have to see if this one works better. And, you know, the other, there's another roll of the dice here, which is, once again, they've turned to the Russians for the Mars landing component of the mission. And, you know, Russia's not had a lot of luck with that. They put a couple of landers on the planet, but they only operated for a very short time or not at all. And they failed as recently as a few years ago with the Schiaparelli probe that the Europeans had on the first ExoMars mission. It was an orbiter and a lander, and then this one's going to be an orbiter and a lander and a rover.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the question mark is can the Russians pull it off this time? And I really hope they do, because they're way overdue for a success. They've been trying since, well, the early 1960s, really, mid-1960s. So it's their turn, you know. So that's going to be an exciting mission if it lands properly. And, boy, if they are able to find, I mean, even just finding fossils of microbial organisms would be incredible. But if they found something living now, besides opening up all kinds of discussions about, you know, how do you have life on another planet? What does that mean in terms of theology and metaphysics and everything else? It opens up another conversation about how careful do we have to be and how we approach Mars so that we don't kill off what's already there.
Yeah.
And that's a tough one.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, one last question. This is Doug on WGN. Go ahead, Doug.
Okay.
Hey. I remember back when the space station was originally, started, they found or they established some goals they wanted to try to accomplish, and one of them was smelting metal at zero gravity. Did they ever do anything with that, and what happened?
Melting metal in zero gravity, is that something that's going on?
Are you talking about manufacturing techniques?
Yeah.
There was some research done on a very small scale. I don't know what the results of it were, but a certain amount of industrial processes has been a primary goal of that station for a long time. Most of it's focused on life science and biomedicine and that kind of thing, long-duration space flight. But there have been a lot of industrial processes investigated, some of them financed by companies on Earth. And actually, there's some of that done on the shuttle as well, because they had a fairly spacious experimental area in the back of the crew compartment. But I don't know a lot of detail more than that. I do know that they did send up a 3D printer a few years ago. That was only working with plastics. It wasn't metal sintering.
Mm-hmm.
They're working on a metal sintering one. But they were able to do successful printing of 3D objects. They printed a couple of tools and so forth. And it's amazing. I mean, 3D printing is pretty cool as it is. But when you think about, again, you're doing it in zero gravity, so stuff is drifting all over the place, and you've got to worry about temperature control. And I interviewed the people that made that 3D printer for a couple hours. And they said, you know, everything from the exact substances they were using to seal the printer, because it had to be atmospherically sealed.
Right.
What's in the plastic, when it melts, you know, what kind of vapors are they emitted. And this is only vaguely related, but I read something the other day. It was actually an article in Ad Astra I was editing, where there's a program that sends books up to the space station for them to read to kids on Earth. And you actually have to use a NASA-certified supplied pen
to sign the book because even the signature might give off enough unwanted vapors that it could be a problem.
Wow.
Up there. So when you start talking about industrial processes like sintering or melting metal or casting or something like that, it gets very, very tricky.
Yeah.
They've done it on a very small scale.
Okay. All right, Doug, thank you for the call. Rod, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you.
And we'll get you back in here in about a month or so. And
let's get back together as soon as we see Ad Astra, because I just can't wait to argue about that.
Yeah, that sounds good. We'll get you on the opening weekend of Ad Astra. We'll get you Ad Astra. We'll get you in there.
And, that'd be cool. Thanks.
All right. Pylebooks.com, PYLEbooks.com. We have a link on our Facebook page. Always a pleasure, Rod. You take care, okay?
Take care, Nick. Thanks.
There you go, buddy. Rod Pyle, everybody. All right. Let's take a break. The news is coming up right after this. Right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN Thursday morning, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. It's one artist, three songs. Who requested that?
It's coming to us from John Indicator, a little Steve Earle.
Yeah, exactly. I like that because now we get to hear two more Steve Earle songs. I happen to like him. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And, Pedro Bell was a Chicago artist. He is the mind behind One Nation Under a Groove and Cosmic Slop. He's a visual artist behind many iconic Funkadelic and George Clinton album covers. He passed away, which is really sad. In his 2014 memoir, Clinton said the band began receiving letters from Bell around 1972. He doodled these intricate wild worlds filled with crazy hypersexual characters and strange slogans, Clinton wrote. Clinton and Bell began speaking over the phone, and from their conversations, Bell created the first cover for Funkadelic, 1973's Cosmic Slop. He sent us his interpretation and I was blown away, Clinton wrote. It includes pimps and hoes, some of which were drawn as aliens with little worms coming out of them. It was nightmarish and funny and beautiful, a perfect fit for the music that we were making. Bell went on to create many of Funkadelic's best-known album covers, including 1974's Standing on the Verge of Getting It On, 1975's Let's Take It to the Stage, 1978's One Nation Under a Groove. He also worked on a string of George Clinton solo covers, including 1982's Computer Games. Bell's work has been displayed in museums and galleries internationally. Bell was profiled by the Chicago Sun-Times in 2009. The piece depicted the artist attempting to sell original versions of his iconic work while living in poverty and struggling with poor health. Bernie Worrell performed a 2009 benefit concert to help raise money for him. He was a great artist, and it's a big loss. And he some of those album covers are just iconic and fantastic. So we're talking about the best album covers of all time here, some of the best. And I'm actually at a website right now called Pocket Lint. Have you ever gone to that website, Tom?
I have not.
I just Googled worst album covers of all time, and the first thing that popped up was the 53 worst album covers of all time at pocketlint.com. And there are a lot. By the way, if you Google worst album covers of all time, lots of links pop up. So there's a whole bunch of websites out there that celebrate the terribleness of some of these album covers, and some of these album covers are ridiculous. I'll describe them as best as I can to you, but if you're near a computer or you got your phone, you might want to Google some of these album covers just because you want to see them to believe. So, 312-981-7200. So we've got some of the greatest album covers of all time. According to Billboard.com, music isn't just about the music. Sure, the sounds are certainly the most essential element, but you can't ignore the role of cover art in making a brilliant album. From the fold-out gatefolds of the vinyl era to the pull-out liner notes of the CD jewel cases to the small icon on a digital player, cover art has changed over the years, but it still defines how we look at a particular album. Photographic portraits, paintings, collages, all of these are on our list, Billboard's list of the 50 greatest album covers of all time. So they put them in order, and the first one on the list, which I think is a great album cover, number 50, is Green Day, American Idiot. It's a great album cover.
It's a very good album cover.
Yeah. It's very, very good. Like the album itself, the art for 2004's American Idiot is hardly subtle. The heart-shaped hand grenade bleeding, designed to mimic communist propaganda, was an integral part of Green Day's angsty tribute to the nation's post-9/11 political turmoil. So, yeah, so that's the first one that Billboard has picked. The next one, number 49, is Taylor Swift, 1989. Which is just like a weird Polaroid.
Yeah, but to me it captures what she's shooting for, which is like her own nostalgic look at the year she was born.
Yeah. Okay. She was born in 1989.
Yeah.
And I'm old.
Where are your wedges, man?
I don't even know them anymore, man. I just don't. Here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with you, man?
All right.
Okay, I'm going to show you both my best and worst album covers. Now, I just discovered recently that these guys are my favorite rock 80s band, and it is Def Leppard. First, I thought the album was called Hysteria, but it's a Pyromania.
Yeah, the Hysteria is the album after Pyromania.
Pyromania is classic because the building explodes with fire. And
No, it's a good album cover. Pyromania is a good. That's a good album cover. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, my second one. This is my worst. Now this album cover has haunted me since I was a kid. It really creeped me out. It'll be also, of course, one of the reasons because the song in the and one of the songs in the album was connected to it. Why my sister listened to it. It was Raspberry Beret, and it was Prince's Around the World in a Day.
So the album cover just freaks you out?
Yeah, it does.
Oh, I love that album cover. I think it's a great album cover. But yeah, it's interesting. All right, Ike, thanks, man.
No problem.
All right. Yeah, I love Around the World in a Day. Great album and a great album cover.
It's kind of like that painted one with the kid on the balloon. And
yeah, there's a bunch of stuff on that cover.
Yeah.
I remember when Around the World in a Day came out. All the original VJs were sitting around on MTV, like on the floor, you know, analyzing. Because Raspberry Beret, the video for Raspberry Beret, which is a kind of an iconic video, had just been released. And he released Around the World in a Day, like, less than a year after Purple Rain. I mean, he just, you know, just there it was. So it was a huge, like, when it first came out, it was massive. And I remember them sitting around, you know, all the original VJs just analyzing everything, including the cover, what it all meant.
That's what's going on,
the
man.
The insight of the VJs of the 80s. Here's Elizabeth on WGN. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning, Nick.
Morning.
I remember this because when I went to Kmart to pick it up, they had it under the cover and if under the counter, and if they had a display, they had a brown paper bag over it. It was Whipped Cream, Herb Alpert, and the Tijuana Brass.
Yeah, that's an album cover that I stared at a lot when I was a kid.
I'll bet you did.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of my favorite album covers. It's fantastic.
I'll bet it is.
Yeah. All right, Elizabeth, thank you.
Good night.
Yeah, that Herb Alpert record, man.
Whipped Cream. Was it Love Potion number 9, right?
Well, that album cover is legendary. And and it was really funny because years later, I want to say it was like 25 or 30 years later, they had the model come back and do the same pose. That's an iconic. I mean, if, you know, you're a boy, that album sticks with you. Like, that album cover sticks with you. You know. And I'll tell you the other ones. And here's this one's next, actually, on the Billboard list, is the Ohio Players' Honey.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. All of the Ohio Players' album covers are magnificent. Because they pretty much always feature naked women. Like, all of the Ohio Players' albums, if you just, like, Google Ohio Players' album covers, it's a plethora of lovely women. And so those the Ohio Players had some of my favorite album covers of all time. You know. And again, as a kid, you know.
Are you so base as to be impressed?
Yeah, well,
I mean, it is great.
It's I love those covers, man. You know, you're like an 11-year-old boy looking at the Ohio Players covers. It's life-changing. It's fantastic. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve.
Morning, Nick.
Morning.
I think one of the coolest album cover would have been the Jethro Tull's first album. This was where everybody had their hair frocked like Christmas trees.
Yeah. Yeah, Jethro Tull's had some memorable album covers.
Back when Ian used to stand up on one leg for half the concert playing the flute.
Yeah, he still does that, man. He still does that. To this day, he'll
really?
Do that. Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah. All right,
and
Steve.
Well, maybe the prettiest would have been the Blind Faith album cover that got banned because it was the pubescent little girl.
Yeah, that's another legendary. The only Blind Faith album. So.
Well, yeah, that was just kind of a flash in the pan. But
yeah, it was just a one-off supergroup. That's all.
Recorded jam festival.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah. Bye.
Yeah, the Blind Faith album was real controversial.
Yeah, I've seen that, and I was just like, yeah,
she's got a metal airplane in her hand. So what do you guys think? 312-981-7200. We're talking about some of the best album covers of all time, and then we'll get to some of the worst too, and I'll describe some of these to you because they're hilarious. There is a Manowar, a cover from the 80s metal group Manowar, and it's their anthology. You got to see this cover. Just if you're near like a googling machine, Google Manowar anthology album cover. But you will not regret it. It is unbelievably hilarious.
There was a kid in my middle school that was really into Manowar.
What?
And he was like the hardcore kid. Like, everybody was kind of afraid of him, but he was actually a really nice dude.
He was into Manowar?
He was super into, like, Manowar. I know he was super into Cannibal Corpse because he used to scare me. I loved his shirts. I loved the Cannibal Corpse shirts, but he scared me. And then one day I talked to him, and he was a real total sweetheart.
Nice guy. He just happened to like Manowar.
He was really into Manowar.
Well, if you're near a Googling hut or a Googling machine, go to Manowar Anthology and take a look at that album cover because it's pretty special. I want to hear from you guys, too. Best album covers, worst album covers, 312-981-7200. Really, before we break, 641 area code says the best album cover of all time is King Crimson in the Court of the Crimson King, one of the greatest album covers ever. Truly one of the greatest. 804 says best album covers Cheap Thrills by Big Brother and the Holding Company, Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd, Highway 61 Revisited by Bob Dylan, all cool for creativity. 224 says the best album cover design ever was either the Beatles White Album or the Beatles Black Album. There you go. All right, let's take a break here and we'll come back. We're talking about some of the great artwork and great album covers of all time. And we're also jumping into the worst stuff, too. So, all right, we'll return after this. Guitar Town. Young Steve Earle. Yeah, there you go. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And, so we're talking about album covers. And Billboard.com put together their list of the 50 best album covers. We're going through that. And I'm looking online at some of the worst album covers I've ever seen. But we want to hear from both ends from you guys here. Best album covers, worst album covers, 312-981-7200. 815 area code text in. The Molly Hatchet album covers are the best. Yeah, those are pretty cool. Those are pretty cool.
Like some Conan the Barbarian stuff.
309 area code says Physical Graffiti LP. The sleeves are a must. Yeah, Physical Graffiti is one of the best album covers ever.
I'd throw out Led Zeppelin 3 because it had the wheel.
It had the wheel, the interactive little wheel that changed what was on the album cover.
Yeah.
I think Zeppelin has a lot of good album covers. I think Presence is a weird and beautiful album cover.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the original. I mean, Led Zeppelin 1.
Led Zeppelin, the self-titled debut album is fantastic. It's a great album
cover. Hindenburg is just...
Yeah. I love Zeppelin 2. I think Zeppelin 2's got a great album cover.
The Brown Bomber.
Yep. So Zeppelin's got a... Ain't Through the Outdoor came in a paper bag.
Yeah.
With just the stamp of In Through the Outdoor on the bag itself.
I will say, I know it's iconic and everything. I'm never a huge fan of Led Zeppelin IV's album cover.
Oh, I like that one.
I like the imagery around it, like the guy, you know, with the lantern and everything, yeah. And all the symbols and everything. But I just, the dude with the sticks on his back.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, this is kind of cool, I guess.
Well, you know, the open up, the gatefold, when you open it up, is fantastic. Like the image that's on the inside, right. the gatefold is really creepy and awesome. Yeah. I wanted to mention really quickly, as far as worst album covers go, you need to Google this. Because a Rudy Ray Moore album is here as one of the worst album covers of all time. And it's his Christmas album. Rudy Ray Moore made a Christmas album. It's called This Ain't No White Christmas. You got to see this album cover. This is something that you have to see. Everybody should Google Rudy Ray Moore, This Ain't No White Christmas. And then just take it all in when you actually see the album cover. Just...
My God.
Isn't that amazing?
That is...
There are five scantily clad ladies surrounding a Christmas tree, and a naked Rudy Ray Moore is putting, like, ornaments on the tree. He seems genuinely shocked that someone took the picture, but that's the album cover. Rudy Ray Moore, very This candid. Ain't No White Christmas. You got to see it to believe it. Here's Jay on WGN. Hi, Jay.
Hey, Nick.
Yeah.
I love your show. I have a comment about the album cover, Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, the Go-Go's. Go-Go's.
The Go-Go's, yeah. Yes. It's timeless. It facial masks, towels, timeless.
Yeah.
I've seen that album, many times in my life. The worst, I think, would be the moon with as a picture of an eye. Maybe it was an eclipse. Staring at a scantily clad lady. I believe that was from the Cranberries.
Oh, the Cranberries. Okay.
The Cranberries.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Take care.
You're welcome. All right. Thanks.
Go-Go's Beauty and the Beat.
Classic.
Classic album cover. Classic album.
Totally.
Great album. All right. Next here on the Billboard list is Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, It's Blitz. I'm not familiar.
Yeah, this is from, I want to say, 2009.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what it says here.
Yeah, it's kind of like an avant-garde sort of piece where she's like crushing an egg or something. Yeah. But the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs were part of the like rock revival of
the Killers and all that stuff, right?
Yeah, a little bit more like the Strokes, because they were all localized.
The Strokes, right? Yeah.
All localized in New York.
Yeah.
But the first, I'm not a massive fan of the Yeah, Yeah, Yeahs, but their first album, Fever to Tell, is an awesome record.
Okay. How about this? Wanted, the Outlaws, Waylon Jennings, Jesse Coulter, Willie Nelson, and Tom Paul Glazer. That's a really great record. A great album. It was the first country album to sell a million copies. And it's got a pretty iconic album cover. Lady Gaga, The Fame Monster. I'm looking at it, and she's got some weird wig on. She's covering her face. She's not in a meat suit, though.
Yeah, that's the one thing. I wish the meat suit had made it onto like an album cover.
Remember when she showed up at one of the award shows in an egg?
Yeah.
What the hell is wrong with her?
I don't know, man. There's weirder things that have been done, I think.
I think it's weird for weird's sake. I've never been a big Lady Gaga. I really liked her in Star Is Born. I will say that. I thought she was great in Star Is Born, and I like the music in Star Is Born, but everything else she's done, I just don't care.
She was a big deal when I was in high school.
She's still a big deal.
Yeah, but when that first album, The Fame, came out, I think is what it was called, but people could not stop listening to Lady Gaga.
Yeah.
Not me. I mean,
I could stop.
I wasn't super into her.
Yeah.
But
next one here is Janet Jackson, Rhythm Nation 1814. Yeah, black and white cover, wearing her Rhythm Nation outfit. Another great record. Produced by Terry Thomas and Huey Lewis, as I like to call them. Terry Thomas and Huey Lewis produced that record. How about this? MIA, Kayla. That's a pretty cool album cover.
Yeah, that's the one with Paper Planes on it.
Yeah.
That was her big hit.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, you know, how many times did we hear that in different commercials and different movies? It's in Pineapple Express. It was everywhere. The trailer for Pineapple Express, that I just remember that song being on it. I'll give you another worst one here that you can look up.
Oh, boy.
How about Rat On by Swamp Dog? With two G's. This is a 1971 album. Boy, he's way ahead of time. He had two G's in his last name there. Now Snoop does it. But this is Swamp Dog. The album is called Rat On, and it's Swamp Dog on top, seemingly riding a giant rat. That's
a great album cover. I don't know what these guys are talking about. I love this. And he just kind of like, he's got like a fringed
yeah.
vest.
No, that's a 1971 garb. He's got the hat, the whole deal, and he's on top of a giant rat.
Love it.
Yeah.
Swamp Dog,
look it up. Rat On. All right, let's break here. We want to hear from you guys, best and worst album covers. And I'll keep looking at some of these worst ones and telling you guys to Google these because you want to see them. All right, we'll take a break here. The news is up after this.
They buy 100 pounds of yeast, fancy copper line. Everybody knew that it made me shine. And I'm a revenue man, want a granddaddy bad. Head left a holler of everything. Time, but I've been told I'll never come back from Copperhead Road.
Great song. Steve Earle, everybody, Copperhead Road. That's a great album cover. We're talking about great album covers and terrible album covers. What are the best and worst album covers? That's a great album cover. Copperhead Road by Steve Earle. Yeah. Welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here on Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. 312-981-7200. And we are talking about some of the best album covers of all time and some of the worst. Here are some more texts that are coming in. We'd love to hear from you. Talk or text right now on the subject of album covers. 312-981-7200. 630 area code says, hey, Nick, one of the album covers I was scared of was the self-titled Black Sabbath album with the Green Witch on the front in the graveyard. It goes too well with the music. One of the best album covers ever. Is the first Black Sabbath record. Really creepy and really cool. Scared the hell out of people when they first hit the scene. Nobody knew what to make of Sabbath. They're like, what is happening? What is this?
Bunch of these guys from Birmingham.
In the first album, man, I couldn't even imagine. I mean, I was, you know, when the first album came out, I was like 4 or 3 when it first came out. I got into Sabbath really early, though. I mean, like I've talked about before, the first album I ever bought with my own money was Paranoid. Which is also a great album cover. 312 area code says Kansas Point of No Return. That's a pretty cool album cover. That's like a quintessential like late 70s album cover. The artwork. 815 area code says Aerosmith Night in the Ruts. That's Max from Joliet. Yeah, it's a picture of them in a coal mine or something. Like a black and white picture. All right, here's another one to Google if you want to see something ridiculous. One of the worst album covers. This is by the Sherwood Singers. The Sherwood Singers. And it's called Something Special. You got to see this album cover. So you Google that, Sherwood Singers. And the album is called Something Special. So you can enjoy the matching outfits and the weird hair. So clearly, like late 60s or early 70s, this was.
What the hell?
That's the Sherwood Singers with Something Special. Everybody, take a look at that.
Did you know Phil Hartman designed album?
Oh, yeah.
I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Harold just called in.
He was an art director before. He was an art director before he went into comedy. Yeah, he designed a bunch of album covers. One of the ones that the first one pops into my head was he did one of the albums for. He did an album cover. He did a couple albums for Poco. For the band Poco. All right, considered one of the best is Lucinda Williams' Car Wheels on Gravel on a Gravel Road, which is a beautiful album cover and a really beautiful album too. So, How about this? Funkadelic. Maggot Brain from 1971, a screaming Barbara Cheeseboro, who was Essence's first cover model, possesses the maggot brain in question on the cover of Parliament's classic 71 album of the same name. Buried up to her neck, the real twist comes when you turn the album over, where her head is on the front and there's a skull on the back. Yeah, that's a good one. They next picked the first album by Whitney Houston, where it's just this portrait of Whitney Houston, who looks like she's 11 on the cover of this record. That was from 1985. Gary Gross shot that photo. He also took photos of an underage Brooke Shields. And when she was like, nude photos of Brooke Shields when she was underage.
What?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, God.
Brooke Shields, you know, because Brooke Shields is exactly my age. So I kind of, you know, kind of grew up knowing Brooke Shields and having kind of a, you know, little crush on her and stuff. But she was notoriously sexualized at a young age.
Well, she was Calvin Klein really early,
Calvin,
right?
Calvin, she was like, nothing comes between me and my Calvins.
Yeah.
She was like 15 or so. So I'm the same age as her. So when that stuff was around, I was like, whoa. She's also in, you ever see the movie Pretty Baby?
No. No.
Susan Sarandon. It's a Louis Malle film.
Mm.
Yeah, she's like 12, and she's like plays a prostitute in it. Yeah.
Jeez.
Pretty Baby.
Well, you know, she's not the first person to do that. You know,
well,
very
no.
young age.
Yeah, well, Jodie Foster played it. Yeah. She was a prostitute.
The grim reality, though.
All right, how about Kevin Rowland, My Beauty? Why don't you look that one up? Kevin Rowland, Rowland. The album's called My Beauty. Kevin Rowland, My Beauty. See if you can get to sleep after seeing this album cover. You say everybody near your Google machine.
You know, I think the IT guys are going to get really mad at me because they're going to be like, what are you looking up?
Kevin Rowland, My Beauty.
So I'm to assume that the man on the cover here is Kevin Rowland.
I would think he's Kevin Rowland.
Yeah. In pearls, a little bit of lipstick.
Yeah.
What can be described as probably a velvet dress of some sort.
Yeah.
Holding it up and in lingerie.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
Yep.
So enjoy that one while you try to sleep, everybody. We're talking album covers, most memorable ones, best ones, even worse ones. Here's Steve on WGN. Hi, Steve.
Hey, well, probably one of my favorites is Pink Floyd, Wish You Were Here. I just can't explain the whole album cover, but the fun of it just kills me.
Couple of guys shaking hands, and one of them's on fire.
Yep.
What's there to get?
And there was a disturbing one. I think it was late 70s, early 80s. I don't know. It disturbed me. Uriah Heep, Abominal.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. I remember that one. Yeah.
I just wanted to toss those in.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Yep.
Wish You Were Here is a great album cover.
It's probably my favorite. It's my favorite Pink Floyd album.
That's your favorite Pink Floyd album?
Yeah. Wow. It cuts deep, man. It cuts real deep.
Well, it's all about Syd Barrett. The whole album is about Shine On You Crazy Diamond. That's all Syd. That's all about Syd.
Yeah, but just like the general themes of, you know, longing for someone and, you know, someone that used to be
really
important.
Record. I wouldn't say it's it's The Wall for me.
See, I think The Wall is really impressive, but like at times, I think, what's his name? Bass player.
Roger Waters?
Roger Waters might be thinking he's a little bit deeper than he actually is.
Well, I mean, you know, he went on to do a couple more like solo records that were concept records. Pros and Cons of Hitchhiking.
Yeah.
Radio Chaos. Those were all solo records. And the Final Cut is kind of the first. It's billed as Pink Floyd, but it's kind of the first Roger Waters solo record.
Yeah. And I think The Wall is great. There's amazing songs on it. Undeniable. But there's a few I'd put ahead of it.
I was 15 when that album came out. So a 15-year-old boy gets The Wall. You're going to listen to it constantly. And that's what I did. I became obsessed with it. A 15-year-old boy. And The Wall, like, for some reason, The Wall spoke to me. Now, to be sure, Roger Waters has many, many, many issues with women and mother issues. There's no question about it. You know, and some of them are kind of ugly. I would be the first to admit that. But when you're a 15-year-old kid and you hear The Wall for the first time, man, it's just like, huh? So, all right, you want another one that we can you can Google here?
Please.
Wayne Cochran. Going back to Miami. Going, no G with an apostrophe there. Going back to Miami. Wayne Cochran. Now, Wayne Cochran, by the way, is a he's a great artist, but this is just like, whoa. Yeah. Everybody, Wayne Cochran going back to Miami.
The man's got a Twinkie on his head.
It's a large pompadour.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
Looks like blonde cotton candy.
Yeah. All right, we got a few more here that we're going to get to. Let me give you this one here. I'm going to have to spell the name because you got to see this album cover. This is Svetlana Gruberslavic, and that's Gruberslavic. Gruberslavic. Svetlana Gruberslavic. The name of the album is My Lips Are For Blowing. That's the name. The image is pretty spectacular. Did you find it, Tom?
Can you spell Gruberslavic again,
it's
please?
Gruberslavic. Svetlana Gruberslavic. My Lips Are For Blowing. I hope you're playing along at home. I hope you're playing along at home because some of these you got to see. You truly have to see some of these to believe it. And I love the album. The album's name is fantastic. My Lips Are For Blowing. All right. Let's take a break here for some weather. And then we'll get back to what are some of your favorite album covers of all time? 312-981-7200. I'll tell you something. It's so different now when you listen to music. Back when I was a kid, you'd put the album on the the turntable and you would stare at the album cover or you'd read the liner notes. You'd follow along. Now you just like get your like little your phone and your little thing and you press it and it plays.
I take notes.
Yeah, but the artwork though was album covers were really important.
Well, people are still going to the record store now.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, no, I'm glad to see the resurgence in vinyl and the artwork and stuff like that. You know, guys like Jack White, what they're doing with vinyl and the kind of experiments that they're doing and all that kind of stuff. And I love that album covers are people are embracing albums again. And I also love the fact this is a little weird thing. But I love the fact that on talk shows now, when they have a musical guest, they hold up an album.
Yeah, if they have a pressed album. If they,
hold up an album. You know what I mean? And I think that's awesome. Because it used to be CD. They would hold up the CD.
And it kind of looked ridiculous.
Yeah.
So little.
But, now they hold up an album. I like that. For some reason, that little detail of late night television pleases me. Okay. My Lips Are For Blowing, everybody. By Svetlana Gruberslavic. that's a must buy right there. Okay, best album covers ever and worst album covers ever. We're talking about really memorable album cover art. Jitterbug. 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 You put the boom boom into my heart. You send my soul sky high when you love in sparks. Jitterbug. Love Wham. I love Wham very much. Triple Play Thursday. Yippee, Triple Play Thursday. Who requested the Wham?
That's coming to us from our good pal Ike.
Ike, all right. And they never heard from Ridgely again. every George Michael reference in Keanu is funny. Every one of them. And they never heard from Ridgely again. Oh, man. All right. Hey, coming up at 5 o'clock, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. All right, Pedro Bell passed away, so he designed some iconic and awesome album covers for George Clinton and Funkadelic, and so we were talking about some of our favorite album covers, some of the best. Next on this list from Billboard.com is Fleetwood Mac Rumors, which is an absolute classic, album cover. And again, that was one of those albums that in the 70s, if you didn't have it, the FBI could bust into your house and throw you in jail. If you had a record collection, you didn't have Rumors.
I think still to this day, that would hold up in a court of law.
Yeah. Nicki Minaj comes in next. The Pink Print. Not familiar. Kind of a weird album cover. All right, here's another one for you to Google. You ready, Tom? And everybody at home, I hope you're playing along. I hope you got your Google machine and you're Googling it. Because this one's really spectacular. Are you ready? It's Uncle Les and Aunt Nancy Wheeler. Uncle Les and Aunt Nancy Wheeler. And the album is called Do You Know Jesus? Uncle Les and Aunt Nancy Wheeler. Do You Know Jesus? So, take a gander at that one.
You know, I gotta say, the album title is one thing. The puppet in the middle of who I can only assume are Uncle Les and Aunt Nancy Wheeler is a little bit much.
But it says featuring somebody on the bottom, and I think that's they're acknowledging the ventriloquist dummy. Because you got to see this. It's Uncle Les and Aunt Nancy Wheeler. They're just there in their late 60s outfits, and they are holding up a very creepy ventriloquist dummy wearing plaid pants. And the album is called Do You Know Jesus? I'm baffled by everything about this album cover. From the artist to the title to the ventriloquist dummy, it's a really baffling image.
I'm trying to figure out what the name of the dummy is, but every picture of this LP, the light catches.
It's you can't, and also the font is almost the same color as the background. You know what I mean? Like the color of the font, and they put the name of the ventriloquist dummy right over his plaid pants. So you have to make your way through a light green font to stare into plaid pants.
As far as I know, I don't think anybody actually knows.
Maybe it's Woody.
It could be. It kind of look. It's a D-Y at the end.
I think it's an O-D-Y. But I can't tell. Maybe somebody at home is Googling it and is looking at Do You Know Jesus by Uncle Les and Aunt Nancy Wheeler.
Good Lord, why?
It's so special. Here's Roger on WGN. Hi, Roger.
Hey, Nick. How you doing, bud?
All right. What's up?
Okay. One of the best ones is Emerson, Lake & Palmer, Brain Salad Surgery.
That is fantastic.
It's an amazing cover.
Yeah, it is.
And the other one is it's simple, but it's really good. Is Mike Oldfield, Tubular Bells?
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a classic one. And people would blow weed and just look at that album cover for 3 hours.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I've been there, done that.
All right, Roger, thanks.
Okay, Nick.
Yeah, if you've never seen the album cover for Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, Black, or Brain Salad Surgery, it's pretty great. It's pretty great. So we are talking about album covers, and we want to hear from you guys. 312-981-7200. Next one on this Billboard.com list is No Doubt's Tragic Kingdom. And then they just simply put Beyonce from 2013. The album cover just has her name on it.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
It was a bold statement.
Yeah. The Beyonce thing it baffles me. I've said this before. I don't understand all the insanity over Beyonce. I don't get it at all. I don't get it. All right, here's another one for you to Google. You ready, Tom? This one's very special. Still trying to figure out the name of the ventriloquist dummy. You ready? This is a band called The Handsome Beasts, and the album is called Bestiality. The album is called Bestiality, and the group is called The Handsome Beasts. And This one, you gotta, you really do have to see this one. I hope you guys are, like I said, I hope you guys are playing along at home. The Handsome Beasts with Beastiality.
Oh, come on, man. I hate this game. God. Jeez, man. Oh, God.
That's pretty great, huh? Yeah.
I've never seen a man look more like an animal.
And he's holding a "Please do not feed the animals" sign.
So it's a large, portly man
next to a large, portly pig. And he appears to be naked. Yeah. So there it is. Yeah. How about this one? 260 area code. We're getting texts and calls here. We want to hear from you. Album covers, great and bad. 312-981-7200. 260 area code says ELP Love Beach is terrible. Yes, it is. Um, 847 area code says Eminem's mainstream debut album, the Slim Shady LP. I love the cover, and the album for my generation was shocking. In my generation, but now it's more commonplace. 331 area codes. I think that Weird Al Yankovic's albums have good covers, some better than others. Well, his album cover for Fat, didn't he do an album cover for Fat, like, which was his takeoff on Bad? He like recreated the didn't he recreate the didn't he
yeah recreate? It's he recreated it. It's just instead of Michael Jackson, it's Weird Al Yankovic, Fat.
Yeah. 847 area code says, I like the Demons and Wizards cover from Uriah Heep. Here's one that I can't believe. Here's an artist that I cannot believe has not come up yet, even including from me. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes has some of the greatest album covers of all time, back in their heyday, like in the 70s.
I like Closer to the Edge. That's a really
Close
cool.
to the Edge is a great album cover. Tales of Topographic Oceans. They had a ton. They had a great logo. Yes has a great logo. And that was another, those were another series of albums, those albums from the 70s that, yes, Fragile, those albums from the 70s by Yes, people would blow a ton of weed and then just stare at those covers.
Man, it's like the earth.
Yeah.
Or something.
So, all right, we got a ton of texts coming in. And I'm going to get my copy. I'm going to go on eBay right now to get a copy of The Handsome Beasts, Beastiality.
I got to throw this in here. From the 972, they figured it out. It's the dummy's name is Randy.
Oh, no.
Uncle Les, Nancy Wheeler,
and featuring Randy.
Randy the doll.
The dummy. Terrifying. Well, we thank you, listeners, for that, and I'll give you some more things to Google. And images that will haunt you for the rest of the morning, right after we break here for the news. How can people not love Wham and everything about Wham? Wham rules. Never seen Ridgely again. I was so sad when George Michael passed away.
Yeah, it was devastating.
It was Christmas Day.
Yeah.
I remember we my folks and I just got out of a movie. We saw that damn, I think it was the that terrible movie with Bryan Cranston and his daughter is going to marry James Franco.
Why him?
Yeah. That's
oh, God. Talk about adding insult to injury.
I'm standing in the lobby of the theater. My parents are in the bathroom, and I'm waiting for them, and I turn my phone on. My phone is going, you know, nuts because people know how much I love George Michael. And I'm standing there, and I'm like, I looked at my phone, and I'm like, man, I just saw that movie, and George Michael passed away. Yeah, why him?
Why him? Why this? Why this movie?
Who was the girl? Who played his daughter?
God.
I can't remember who it was. Somebody I like, too. I like her very much.
It is...
It's really...
Zoe Deutsch.
Yeah, Deutsch. Yeah, she's awesome.
That's really how you say her last name is Deutsch?
Yeah, Howard Deutsch's daughter. That's Leah Thompson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Leah Thompson's daughter.
Oh, no way.
She's married to Howard Deutsch, the director, Howard Deutsch. They met on the set of Some Kind of Wonderful. and they got married. And now their daughter is in movies. She's really good. She was great in Everybody Wants Some.
Yeah, very good.
So, all right, album covers is what we're talking about. We lost a great artist, Pedro Bell, and he did a lot of album covers, some really great ones, particularly for Funkadelic and George Clinton. And so we're talking about great album covers and terrible album covers and everything in between. And we've got this Billboard.com list here of some of the more memorable ones. And some of your best. And I also am looking online here at some of the worst album covers that everybody should play along at home. 815 area code says, I was not ready for that Kevin Rowland. What a album cover. What a night ruiner that album cover is. 312 area code says, Bob Mould, Workbook, which is another good album cover. Sebastian in Germany says, Huey Lewis in the News, Sports. Classic. Classic. I like the very best of ELO's album cover. That's Mike from Louisville. 847 area code says, a wizard, a true star, Todd Rundgren was pretty cool. Yeah, Todd Rundgren's actually got some pretty cool album covers all over the place. Even with Utopia, especially, you know, Utopia. They've got some really good album covers, too. 630 area code says, any Frank Zappa albums? 630 area code says, Elton John, Captain Fantastic, and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, and Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Both great album covers. Yeah, those are both great. Top of the morning from Anne in Ireland. Hi, Anne in Ireland. I wonder what part of Ireland Anne is in. And whatever part of it is, it's beautiful and lovely. Best album cover, Rio, Duran Duran. That's a great album cover. Classic. Next one is Johnny Cash, that they mentioned, American Four, The Man Comes Around, from 2002. Just a simple black and white album cover. Just says Cash on it. Madonna's third studio album they picked, True Blue. That's a great album cover because it's just her. It's just her with the iconic blonde hair that she wore. Her Brits photographed her for that.
In all her splendor.
Yeah. I love her. All right. Are you ready for another Googler?
I don't know if I am, but okay, here. Hit me.
Okay. You ready? John Bolt, B-U-L-T. Bolt, B-U-L-T. And the album is called Julie's 16th Birthday.
Oh, I don't like that.
John Bolt, B-U-L-T. And the album is called Julie's 16th Birthday.
What the hell is this? Oh, God. So I'm going to assume that the gentleman on the right is John Bolt.
John Bolt in his beer.
In his beer and ash
cigarette. Tray. And he's got a fantastic beard and a weird hat.
Yeah.
And he's with a very sullen, sad-looking girl that Julie, I think, is having a bad 16th birthday.
And I can only assume that he is either her... father, maybe uncle?
Well, here's the story behind it. I actually have the story. His one and only LP, Julie's 16th Birthday, should have been his calling card to country music stardom. Instead, the album has been singled out as the best of the worst, not for Bolt's singing abilities, but for the unfortunate cover art. And here's the background on the title and the music and of course the fantastic iconic album cover. Julie's 16th birthday tells the story of Jim, a guy who hangs out in bars and enjoys a drink or two, a little more than he should. He tells his friend Lou that he can't stay at the bar long tonight because his daughter Julie is turning 16 that very day. And going out on her first date. But Jim loses track of time and the number of beers that he's had and proceeds to get behind the wheel of his car where he hopes to speed back in time to see Julie off on her big night. As he reaches for a bottle of booze under the seat, he slams into an oncoming car. In the hospital, Jim learns that a young man was injured and a teenage girl died. That's the story behind.
What?
That's the story behind. Julie's 16th birthday.
is it fair to assume that is Julie? That he
I don't know. That's fantastic. That's the story.
That's dark, dude.
Julie's 16th birthday. Oh, man.
Jeez.
All right, how about this one? You ready for another one here? Google.
Okay.
Orion, or Orion, O-R-I-O-N, and the album is called Reborn. So I'm pretty sure it's probably Orion. Yeah, so Reborn is the name of is the name of the record. So everybody do a little Google on that one.
Oh my god. I like to believe that this is actually Orion Samuelson's alter ego,
yeah.
Orion.
Yeah.
And he had a prolific music career and he wears a mask so that no one knows it's him.
Yeah. That's him. All right. Let's see. Here's Tim on WGN. Hi, Tim.
Hey, how about Smell the Glove from Spinal Tap?
Yeah, you can't get more black. No blacker. Can't
how
get
much
black.
More? None more.
None more. None more.
Yeah. Rush 2112.
Yeah. Oh, Rush 2112. Classic.
Awesome.
Yeah, classic.
Indeed. I'm going through. I got a whole stack of them. Oh, ZZ Top we got. Oh, my God. There's
Fun. It's fun to look at those album covers, man. It really is. Tim, thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Yeah. Smell the Glove. How about Joni Mitchell? Let's see. What's next? Oh, here we go. This is a great one. Master of Puppets, Metallica.
Yep.
Great album cover.
Great album.
Yeah. Well, yes. Absolutely.
I think And Justice for All has a really great album cover, but I've got issues with that one.
With the album?
Yeah. Because the mixing is legendarily bad.
Yeah.
They just decide, they're like, yeah, we want you to like basically take out all the bass. And the engineer, he's been interviewed about it, and he's just like, yeah, I did not decide to do that. They asked me to do it. And he's like, are you sure? And so it resulted in a very tinny album, despite having really great songs.
Yeah. All right, here's another one that we can Google here before we break for some weather. You ready? Country Church. By Country Church, the self-titled album by Country Church. I think you're going to have to like be a little more specific when you Google that, because I think Country Church is going to come up with a lot of stuff.
No, I think I got it.
Oh, you got it? Country Church? Do you see this?
Some pretty good mustaches on display.
Yes, and nice vests.
I'm trying to see if they have a song just called Country Church.
Because the album is Country Church by Country Church.
They do not, but...
That's too bad.
Yeah. No, such hits as The Old Rugged Cross Made the Difference and Who Is on the Lord's Side.
Wow.
So.
I wonder if they know Uncle Les and Aunt Millie or whatever the hell, because Do You Know Jesus?
Do You Know Jesus? This is the answer. The answer is yes.
Country Church. Yeah, look that one up, everybody. Enjoy. All right, we're talking album covers. We'd love to hear from you. What are some memorable ones, some great ones, some bad ones? 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. And I hope you guys are playing along and Googling some of these, because some of them are a real treat. Don't you know that, baby, I'm your man. You bet. If you're gonna do it right, do it with me. If you're gonna do it right, do it with me. If you're gonna do it right. That's right, man. Wham. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Skyline studio here, 18 stories of beautiful downtown Chicago, here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple A Thursday. Yeah, Triple A Thursday. And we're talking album covers. The best, the worst, the weirdest, the most memorable. We want to hear from you via talk or text. Let's do it. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Next one on the best list, according to Billboard, is The Slits, Cut, from 1979. Then you got Kanye West, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, from 2010. I'm, again, not familiar.
It's an awesome album cover.
Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bullocks, Here's the Sex Pistols. Classic album cover. FKA Twigs, LP1. I don't know what that is.
It's a more recent kind of like indie pop artist, a little bit electronic, and it's just kind of like a, I don't know if it's her or what it is, but it's kind of like a porcelain doll with all these kind of weird colors on
yeah.
it. It's very cool.
I'm looking at the cover. I just don't know who, not familiar with this person's work or this thing. Next one up here is Aretha Franklin, I Never Loved a Man the Way I Love You. Classic album cover. And it's her best album. Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. Iconic album cover right there. Featuring Bruce's butt. So, classic one, Janis Joplin, Pearl. A really lovely portrait of Janis Joplin on the cover of that. That's a really great album cover. That's her final album. Came out after she died. Okay, you want another one? To Google? Yes,
go ahead.
All right.
If you must.
It's simply called Ken by request only. So Google that album cover and enjoy.
You know what? I think I've definitely seen this one before.
Ken by request only. It's pretty special.
I mean, I would love to have my, I wish I could have had my headshot done like this.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
That's 70s, man. We've got family pictures like that.
DiGilio by request only.
All right, how about this one? Wolf by Wolf. This is one of the weirdest album covers I've ever seen. Wolf by Wolf. Were you able to find it?
Yeah, it doesn't even look like a wolf. Kind of looks like a bat thing.
But he's got like. His fingers have eyes.
Yeah, they're like little vultures.
Yeah.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, that's Wolf by Wolf. It's pretty memorable album cover right there. Here's a few more. Texts, 312-981-7200. 773 area code says, Nick, what did you think of Barbara Streisand's Superman in her Superman t-shirt? Yeah, that's a she's on the cover with a Superman t-shirt and some... if I remember correctly, very, very short shorts. And that's when she had the Star is Born hair, the perm. Her Butterfly with the Fly on Butter. You got Roberta Flack's Killing Me Softly. And Stevie Wonder's Talking Book, which had Braille on the cover. Yeah, Talking Book is a classic record. Caribbean Bob says Alan Parsons' I, Robot is a great cover. Chris from Chicago said best album cover is Metallica Ride the Lightning. It's an electric chair on the cover, not a microphone. A visually stunning cover. Um, 312 area code says Black Sabbath's first album, which we mentioned already, and Black Sabbath Technical Ecstasy. Technical Ecstasy, very cool album cover, not a great album, though.
Was that the final one with Ozzy?
No, the final one with Ozzy was Never Say Die.
Oh, okay. I like Never Say Die. I think that one's pretty good.
Yeah, he was
he was coked out.
He was out of his mind during that. That's when they fired him. They fired him during that tour because he couldn't even stand up. What a comeback story, though, for that guy.
Mm-hmm.
You can thank Sharon for a lot of it.
Absolutely.
Let's see. Len says the original cover for the Beatles Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Yeah, that's the Butcher Baby cover, which they changed, obviously. There's always two virgins. Oh, sure. Dennis from Kankakee said, how about the first three Santana albums? They were all pretty cool. Yeah, Santana, some pretty cool album covers, for sure. I don't know if it's as good as Wolf by Wolf. Next here, Grace Jones, Island Life. Is on the best list. David Bowie, Aladdin Sane. Iconic look that David Bowie has on the cover of that.
Yeah, the lightning bolt.
Yeah. Now, here's one. It comes in at number 22, and I kind of think it should be higher. Rolling Stone's Sticky Fingers. I have a copy at home with the working zipper. The zipper that actually goes down and up on the pants. For those of you who don't know what Sticky Fingers is, just... very close up of a crotch with jeans on. Miles Davis, Bitches Brew, great, great awesome album cover. Number 20, we've mentioned this one already. Duran Duran, Rio. An iconic, iconic album cover. Let's see, you want another one here you can Google?
Yeah.
The Handsome Beasts, 04. That's the name of the album. The Handsome Beasts, 04.
Now, the last one by the Handsome Beasts was A Man in a Pig Pen.
Yes. So check out The Handsome Beasts, 04. I guess the Handsome Beasts are known for their particular style of album cover.
Oh, what the hell?
There's another pig on the cover of this
pig.
One. And another portly gentleman.
Portly gentleman. A Japanese schoolgirl.
Right.
And a nun in lingerie smoking a cigarette.
Don't forget about the screaming Doberman next to her.
Yeah. I mean, this just makes sense.
Yeah. The Handsome Beasts, 04, if you want to Google that one. So.
I wonder what Uncle Les would think of that one.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd be worried about the dummy.
Randy.
Randy the dummy. Next one here that they have on the best is Joy Division, Unknown Pleasures.
Yep. That's probably my favorite album cover of all time.
It's a great one. Next, Judas Priest, British Steel.
Nice. Very nice.
That's a great album cover.
It's got a... Does that one have Hellbent? Sorry. Hellbent is on Hellbent.
It's on Hellbent. All right. They include on the worst album covers Scorpion's Love Drive, which is... I love that album cover, but they've included it on the worst. And it was a controversial album cover because they were forced to change it. Yeah. How about these guys? Here's one of the worst ones. Let me spell this for you. These guys are German metal band. They're called Norkator. That's Knorkator. Norkator.
Okay.
And the album is called Hassan Chartbreaker. All one word, Hassan Chartbreaker by Norkator. Knorkator.
Yeah, this is a real winner. Three dudes in discount Kiss makeup.
The guy on the far left, I think, is my favorite. The first guy is my favorite. You got to check this out. Norkator, Knorkator, Hassan Chartbreaker. What's the name of the record? All right, more album covers. It's a lost art, especially by Norkator. We'll take a break. The news is up after this.
How far is heaven? Let's go tonight. I want my daddy to hold me tight.
Right.
A little girl.
Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, and we are live in the Skyline studio here until 5 o'clock. It's Thursday morning, triple play Thursday. This won't be a triple play. It'll just be a double play. Who requested?
So that's coming to us from Doc. It's Kitty Wells.
Kitty Wells.
The queen of country music. She would have been 100 years old tomorrow.
Oh, okay. All right. Welcome back, everybody. We are talking about album covers, having a lot of fun reminiscing and looking back at some of these. Best ones and worst ones. What are your thoughts? 312-981-7200. The wonderful lost art of album cover artwork. 312-981-7200. All right, here's another one for you to Google, Tom. You ready for some fun here?
Yes, sir.
Okay, it's Patty Roberts, P-A-D-D-Y. Patty Roberts and his album Songs for Gay Dogs. That's a... So just Google that and... get a load of this album cover by Patty Roberts, P-A-D-D-Y. Patty Roberts, Songs for Gay Dogs.
It's actually a really nice cover. It's kind of cute. He's just sitting there with his...
with his bulldog.
His bulldog. It just...
who may or may not be gay. We're not sure.
He must be.
Well, yeah, I don't think you'd name the album Songs for Gay Dogs if your dog wasn't gay.
He seems like a very happy dog.
Yeah. All right. So best album covers continues. The Roots, Things Fall Apart. And you've got The Clash, or I'm sorry, you've got Santana, Abraxas. That's probably the one that most people would remember. Although they've got a few. Santana's got a few memorable album covers.
Those early ones are very cool, very psychedelic.
Yeah, here's a great album cover. One of my favorite album covers, London Calling by The Clash.
I figured that'd be a lot higher.
It's at 15.
15? Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
Oh, here's another one for you to Google, Tom.
Oh, boy.
I hope you enjoy this one. The band is called Brainstorm. One word, Brainstorm. And the album is called Smile a While. And I hope you enjoy. What? Brainstorm. Oh, Smile a While.
There's been a consistent theme of guys in women's underwear.
Yeah.
That's happened a few times here.
It has. You can't blame them.
It does seem to fit them quite well.
Brainstorm. It's just, it doesn't fit the band name. You know? Brainstorm.
We're brainstorming of things to do, so we put on women's undies.
Put on some women's underwear. So, if you want to jump in here, some of the most memorable, some of the worst, some of the best album covers of all time, 312-981-7200. Naz, Illmatic, is next on the list of best. The Blink 182 is number 13 with Enema of the State.
Yeah.
Featuring porn star Janine Lidenmulder. It's a very funny album cover.
Yeah. 20 years old this year. Holy cow.
20 years.
Yeah. Wow. They're going to be performing it in its entirety, although minus the original frontman Tom DeLonge. They're going to be playing at Riot Fest.
They are?
Yep.
Oh. Do people still like them?
Yeah, God knows why. I never was super into Blink-182. Few songs here and there.
Yeah.
But, people still go wild for them.
And their video, weren't they running around naked?
Yeah, at least one of them.
Weren't they naked all the time? Wasn't that their thing?
There was them and the Red Hot Chili Peppers, you know, they were constantly naked.
Well, they would have socks over their things.
Yeah. I don't know, man.
Yeah. Okay, next, one of my favorite albums and one of my favorite album covers of all time, Live Through This by Hole. I happen to be a massive Courtney Love fan. I happen to be a huge Courtney Love fan. And, I also think Celebrity Skin is a great album. And Live Through This is legendary. It's classic. Okay, here's another. Get ready to Google this one. This is a special one. Are you ready?
Yes, sir.
This is a really this one. If you're listening and you're at home, you might want to Google this one because this is pretty spectacular. It's simply the artist is simply known as Gary. Okay, it's one R, Gary, and the album is called "Getting Down to Business." Gary, just Gary, Gary, getting down to business, and take a look at that album cover.
The man looks like he's gonna get down to business.
He does look like he's gonna get down to business. I don't understand the empty semi trucks, the trailers behind him. There's a phone booth right there.
Are those bell bottom jeans?
Those are bell bottoms.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the pose.
What's he got in his waistband?
I don't know. Is it a pack of smokes?
It could be a pack of smokes. It looks like it could be a passport.
Well, he's getting down to business.
He is getting super down to business. He's striking a pose.
Yeah.
I feel the energy here. He's got a big energy.
Gary, getting down. Well, because he's getting down to business. Okay. Here's another one. You got to look up this one. You ready? Now I got to spell it out. It's Norberto de Fritas. That's the artist's name. Norberto, N-O-R-B-E-R-T-O, de Fritas. It's a D-E and then a capital F-R-E-I-T-A-S. Norberto de Fritas. So, did anything pop up?
Oh. Well, there you go.
He lacks teeth.
He does. Or it look, I can't tell if he actually lacks teeth or if it was just painted to look that way.
And he's got, he's very happy about life.
Uh-huh.
He seems to be very happy about life. Norberto De Freitas. And he's got sort of a hipster goatee.
Yeah, it kind of looks a little bit like a Billy Goat sort of situation.
Yeah. That's good old Norberto De Freitas.
Gesundheit.
Yeah. He's a good-looking man.
It's all about how you feel, you know?
Yeah.
Got to have a positive mental attitude.
Mm-hmm. All right. I still like Svetlana Gruber-Slavic. My lips are for blowing. That's still one of my favorites. All right. Back to some of the best. Number 11. And I don't know how this didn't make the top, like, five. Easy? Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. How is that not like in the top five for album covers?
I don't know.
Legendary album cover. Number 10, best album covers, is the self-titled Elvis Presley album, which is a fantastic album cover.
Yeah. And that's the one where London Calling takes its inspiration from, right?
Exactly. Yeah. The font and everything.
Yeah.
So that's a great one. I'm trying to think of some that have been missing here. This is a great one. Fear of a Black Planet, Public Enemy, coming in at number nine. That's a great one. So is It Takes a Nation of Millions. Takes a Nation of Millions is a great album cover, too.
That's just Chuck D and Flava Flav.
In jail.
In jail.
It's them in jail.
Just mean mugging.
All right, here's another one before we break for some weather here. Tom, you ready for this one?
Yeah.
Rolf Harris, R-O-L-F. Rolf Harris. The album is called Sings Mary's Boy Child with Some Unusual Songs. Rolf Harris, R-L-O-F, Rolf Harris sings Mary's Boy Child with Some Unusual Songs.
I really hope that kid is his.
Well, have they never seen a lamp?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a particularly religious lamp. There appears to be some sort of stained glass art on it.
But they really, they're looking at it as though they've never seen a lamp before.
This is the miracle of life.
Yeah. Look at that lamp. I've never seen one like that.
What did you put in those brownies, Jimmy?
Rolf Harris, everybody, sings Mary's Boy Child with Some Unusual Songs. I don't even understand the title. I don't understand anything about this. It's an older gentleman with a child, and they're both staring up at a lamp that has some stained glass around it. And he sings Mary's Boy Child with some unusual songs.
I'm freaking out, man.
I don't know what this means. I really don't. All right. Let's break here for some weather. I've got a few more of these terrible album covers, and we have the best album covers coming up right now. We're in the top 10. I'll do one more here before we break for weather. Number 8 on this on the list of best album covers is She's So Unusual by Cyndi Lauper. So that's a pretty classic. That's a pretty classic album cover. I don't know how it could be above Sgt. Pepper. I'm still a little confused why Sgt. Pepper was not in the top, not even in the top 10. It seems strange to me. All right, we'll wrap this all up. Album covers and all kinds of goofy stuff, and I'll give you some more stuff that you can Google. I'm looking at the next one that I'm going to tell you to Google, and I hope everybody's playing along at home.
I don't claim to be an angel. My life's been full of sin, but when I met you, darling, that all came to an end.
All right, welcome back, everybody. It's Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the WGN Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. And, yeah. So, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell and at 5 o'clock, and we're talking about album covers. The best and the worst, the most memorable. We want to hear from you. Phone lines are open. Text lines are open, too. 312-981-7200. So here's another one that you should Google. Oh, by the way, coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom, right here. All right, Tom, you ready? Everybody at home playing along. Freddie Gage, G-A-G-E, Freddie Gage, and his album is called All My Friends Are Dead. That's the name of his album.
And then there he is, just looking at a headstone.
Looking at a headstone with white shoes on.
I love the font.
Yeah.
It's like the All in the Family font.
All My Friends Are Dead by Freddie Gage.
He himself died in 2014.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Houston, Texas.
Well, now he's reunited with his friends.
That's a nice thought.
Yeah. You know, you feel bad for the guy. All his friends are dead. All right, how about this one? The Faith Tones. Give a little giggle on the Faith Tones. And the album is called Jesus Use Me. Do you see this one? The album, the group is called the Faith Tones. And the album is called Jesus Use Me.
Oh, my God.
That's the hair is spectacular.
Yeah, Was that a popular style back in whenever this is?
Yes, it was.
When would you date this? What?
60s.
60s, yeah, for sure.
Without question.
They remind me a little bit of that SNL skit from where they're on the Lawrence Welk show.
Oh, yeah. Where she comes out, she's got the little hands.
Yeah, she's got the little hands. With
Kristen Wiig.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, back to best album covers. Nirvana Nevermind, which is a pretty legendary album cover. But, well, by the way, Weird Al did that one, too.
Yeah.
He parodied that one, too.
Threw himself in the pool.
Yep. I always love the fact that Kurt Cobain said that he realized that the band really made it when Weird Al did a parody song of theirs. He was just, you know, Kurt Cobain was like, yeah, that's fantastic. Number six on the list of best album covers of all time, Dark Side of the Moon, Pink Floyd.
Naturally.
Legendary image.
Covering the dorm rooms of many a student.
Yep. Now we're into the top five. Led Zeppelin's first album, Led Zeppelin, with the Hindenburg picture on it. Number four, fourth best album, according to this, Billboard.com, Notorious B.I.G., Ready to Die.
Yeah, with the baby on the cover, wearing the crown.
Is that him as a baby?
I don't know off the top of my head.
It says, the innocence of baby-sized Biggie on the cover. Well, I guess it's him then. Of the classic album Ready to Die vastly contradicted the content inside. But that was the point. The album traced his life from beginning to a mournful foreshadowing end, using the innocence of a child to illustrate how a cruel world imprints on life. Did you watch that the miniseries Biggie and Smalls? Biggie and Tupac?
I did not.
With Jimmy Simpson?
I did not. Was that good?
It was really good. He's great. Jimmy Simpson's really great. And he was fantastic on Perpetual Grace, as was my future ex-wife, the lovely Dana DiLorenzo.
Apparently, the kid on the cover of Ready to Die is not Biggie.
Oh, it's not.
The New York Daily News confirmed that. That the baby was booked traditionally through a modeling agency, and they did an interview with the kid on the cover. At the time in 2011, that was 18-year-old high school senior and Bronx native Keith Roy Yearwood. So he was like a baby model that was like booked to do an album cover.
And they interviewed him in 2011?
Interviewed him in 2011, New York Daily News.
Okay. So it's not Biggie. We'd like to put that rumor to rest right now. All right, everybody get ready to Google some fun here. This is a great one. Are you ready? Tom, you ready?
Yes, sir.
Get to your Google machines. The artist's name is Jim Post. Jim Post. And the album is called I Love My Life. Jim Post, I Love My Life. Google that one, everybody at home, and take a look at that lovely album cover.
Very good mustache. I'll say that.
A fantastic mustache. He doesn't seem to love his life, though. He's standing underneath a waterfall, shirtless. He does not look happy. He does not look like he loves his life.
Maybe he was going for the irony.
I don't know. But yeah, that's a healthy mustache.
That's what I aspire to.
Yeah, no, that's a healthy mustache. That's a good one. So, Jim Post, I love my life. Okay, again, back to the best album covers. Number three on here is Patti Smith, Horses, which is a great portrait of her. Robert Mapplethorpe is the person who took that picture, actually. Number two on the list of best album covers of all time is the album that our good friend Vic is currently listening to. And that's Abbey Road. Number two. It's weird that Abbey Road... Why is it weird to think for me that Abbey Road is higher than Sgt. Pepper?
I don't know.
On the album cover? They're both great album covers.
Sure. I like Abbey Road's cover more, though.
Do you?
Yeah, there's just something about it. I'm not as big a fan. Maybe it has to do with the records contained therein.
Yeah.
I like Sgt. Pepper's. I recognize its place, but I don't think it's better than Abbey Road.
Oh, I think Abbey Road's better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but I mean,
maybe that might influence it.
Here's another question. How did Revolver not make this list of best albums?
That is very, yeah. Because they clearly weren't limiting it to just one per band.
Right.
Beatles are on there twice.
Revolver is a phenomenal. My two favorite Beatles albums are Revolver and Rubber Soul. That era of Beatles is my favorite. That was that.
Yeah, the transition.
That was that transition, that bridge that they took, you know, from poppy live band to introspective and drug-induced studio band.
Yeah.
But Abbey Road coming in at number two. And we'll find out what Vic thinks of Abbey Road tomorrow.
Yeah.
When we do Vic's picks. And then number one is an album, again, an album that that he just listened to, that Vic just listened to.
Mm-hmm.
The number one is the Velvet Underground and Nico.
There it is.
With the iconic Andy Warhol banana on it.
I mean, I really can't think of anything else that would be number one.
No, I mean, it's one of the most recognized and, you know, iconic album covers of all time.
More people know that album cover than actually know the album.
Yeah, that's
true. Than actually have listened to the Velvet Underground.
Yeah, that's true. I still prefer Songs for Gay Dogs. Oh, man.
I mean, I'm curious about that music. What do Songs for Gay Dogs sound like?
I don't know. All right, the last one to Google here before we break.
Oh, boy.
Is Orleans, the band Orleans. And Waking and Dreaming is the name of the album. And Orleans had a few hits. They had a few hits. And they had a few hits off of this album. But if you Google Orleans and Waking and Dreaming, it's just five shirtless guys touching each other. And they seem very happy about it.
With some truly spectacular facial hair.
Yeah. Well, this was the late 70s.
Yeah.
But Orleans, what do they have there? They had, I think, Dance With Me, I Want to Be Your Partner. I think they did that song, Orleans.
Still the One.
That's the big one.
That's off of Waking and Dreaming.
That's the big one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Still the One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope you enjoyed that little jaunt down album cover village. I hope you were playing along and Googling, because some of those were lots of fun.
And traumatizing, if we're going to be honest.
Yeah, a few of them. What's on the show tomorrow besides the regular Friday features?
We're going to have Mr. Jeff Tuckman. He's got a great giveaway for tomorrow.
Okay. Jeff Tuckman will be down for his monthly visit. Cool. And then we'll have all of our regular Friday features.